is your emergency broadcast system.
Attention! This is an illegal gathering. This event is not permitted by the One World Government. You are in violation of Article 666 under the order of the United Nations 2030 Declaration and Corporate Charter. Make sure you have your health passes ready to be scanned, as well as up-to-date microchips. Emperor Schwa has personally declared a public health emergency of international concern. Cases of the SARS virus are on the rise. If you are not in your designated quarantine facility, you must have valid documentation or you will be detained and risk prosecution.
Attention!
There is no escape. You are being tracked and traced with our 8G surveillance system.
Attention!
For your own safety, remain calm.
Attention!
Stay still and follow instructions. If you are outside of your 15-minute zone, you must return to it now. There is no escape. You are being tracked and traced with our 8G surveillance system. Surveillance drones are currently operating in this area. If you are approached by a drone, for your own safety, remain calm. Stay still and follow instructions. You may be required to scan your personal climate tracker. If you are found to have exceeded your daily carbon allowance, you will be automatically charged for your digital credits, and points will be deducted from your social credit score.
Attention!
There is no escape. You are being tracked and traced with our 8G surveillance system.
Attention!
For your own safety, remain calm.
Attention!
Stay still and follow instructions.
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore, and we hope to see you live again in August next week. Inshallah.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen, nice to have you along. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. New and regular listeners, welcome. Good to have you along. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden in Scandinavia. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays doing radio on important and interesting subjects for your consideration. We highlight everything from conspiracy, secret societies, history, religion, to new and emerging technologies, mass control, geopolitics, the occult, space news, spiritual topics, environmental issues, and much, much more. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Take a look around, follow along in our daily updated news, and don't miss out on the all the material that we have for you in our member section. Video, short films, radio with extended interviews with many of our guests, and much more of that in the pipeline. All information is available on our website. And today we have author Eric John Phelps back with us on the program. He is, of course, behind the book Vatican Assassins. We had Eric with us back in September last year talking about his book, which now it's in its third edition, I think. It's available as a PDF, and it's got an incredible 1,836 pages. His website is vaticanassassins.org. Go there, take a look at all the articles he's got up there for you, and do get a copy of the book if you're interested in the research that we'll be discussing here today. We're going to begin to talk about the Vatican connection and the potential creation of Islam, and move on from there forward in history to discuss some other connections to the consequent terror fraud, as it were, related to Al-Qaeda and what we've seen after the 9/11 attacks, and look at some of the establishment connections to all of this. So with that, welcome back to the program, Eric. Nice to have you on the program again.
Pleasure to be with you, Henrik, and your listeners today.
Thank you for coming on. Much appreciated. I want to begin here right at the top, so to speak, and go back about, 1400 to 1500 years. And the official story goes that the Prophet Muhammad was receiving revelations from God, and that this was memorized and recorded by some of his companions. And this became as what we know as the Quran today. And Muhammad lived between, I think, 570 and 632 BC. I mean, to start right with that, Eric, do you think that that story is a fraud, or is there some truth to that, you think?
Well, as far as Islam being started by Muhammad, is that what the question is?
That's right, that's right.
Well, according to Alberto Rivera, and I believe his testimony in the Chick publication, The Prophet, I believe, and it can be substantiated from a few other sources, that Islam is a creation of the Vatican through the Augustinian monks of North Africa, and that they were the ones who were responsible ultimately for the rise of Muhammad, and that they tutored him also. And the purpose for Islam being created by the Vatican was, number one, to block the true gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ to the Arab people. Number two, to use the Arab peoples for the killing of the racial Jews throughout Arabia and North Africa, and also to use the Arab peoples for the killing off of true Bible-believing Arabs and racial Jews and even some black Africans in northern Africa, going all the way across North Africa to invade Spain, finally, and to kill off the Arians, who denied the Roman Catholic, the papal trinity, as opposed to the biblical Bible-based trinity. And so that's why the Muslims occupied Spain and for nearly some 700 years. So the purpose for the Vatican in creating Islam was to use Islam as a sword of the church to kill off the enemies of the papacy, while at the same time keeping an arm's distance, the papacy keeping an arm's distance from this killing, so it looks like the Vatican is innocent and it's that evil, wicked Islam that's doing it apart from any papal control.
Right, right.
So I get into this in a CD that I have just finished. I use it at the conspiracy conference in June of this year. And I wasn't happy with it. I had put in probably 900 hours in it, and it wasn't a good contrast for a overhead for a PowerPoint. So I added 100 more slides. I completely redid the contrasting. I enlarged the letters, and I finished it about 3 weeks ago. So I have 1,000 hours over in the production of this CD PowerPoint that I get into these points that your listeners can purchase, and then they too can begin to present this to their friends. And it's very user-friendly. The person doesn't have to know anything about it. It's all self-explained with lots of good pictures and illustrations, 412 slides or PowerPoints. But
And that is available at your website, I guess, then?
It's available on my website. Just contact me through the website, and it's 20 Federal Reserve notes plus shipping, and I don't know what the shipping would be in Sweden, but I'll just have to figure that out when I get an order.
Beautiful, yeah.
It's affordable, and I regard it as a tremendous sequel to my book. And by the way, I do have Vatican Assassins now in book form. It's 13 pounds. It's 9.5 by 12. It's 5 inches thick. And so it would cost something to ship, but it is now in one book form, so if anybody would want to have the book, they can also order that too. It's 325 Federal Reserve notes plus shipping, so that's
okay.
Available. And then I have my Jesuit Watch newsletter that comes out bi-monthly, six issues per year, that is now available too, and that's 40 Federal Reserve notes a year. and please forgive me by using the term Federal Reserve notes. They're not dollars.
I understand.
They're Federal Reserve notes, so in being a Bible believer, I should be honest about what the notes we're using. So that's, in fact, what they are.
Well, it's good to clarify that. That gives a kind of a mental reminder of what it is you guys are dealing with over there, so to speak. So that's a good one.
Right. The post Federal Reserve Bank with the post Federal Reserve notes, and the Federal Reserve notes are nothing more than indulgences, evidences of debt, so we can go out and sin and incur debt to be more indebted to the Federal Reserve Bank controlled by the Knights of Malta.
There you go. Okay, let's get back on track here, Eric, and talk a little bit more about you mentioned the Augustinian monks. Do you think that they are potentially then responsible for pinning down the Quran, or do you think that this was actually written by an historical character like Muhammad?
No, Muhammad was an illiterate. He couldn't write. So it was done by others, just like Mein Kampf was written by others. Hitler was not an author. He never wrote a book. He didn't have the capacity. So same way with Muhammad. So it was written for Muhammad, and I'm convinced that priests of North Africa had a hand in writing it. And you can find many of the tenets in the Quran to be the exact same tenets of the Roman Catholic canon law. For example, one of the tenets of Islam is that those who do not believe in the false prophet Muhammad are what are called infidels. Well, in Romanism, in the teaching of the canon law, if you're not a member of the Roman Catholic Church, if you don't believe in the false prophet, the Pope, because the Pope considers himself a prophet, if you don't believe in the Pope, you're a heretic. So what is deemed an infidel in Islam and worthy of death is deemed a heretic in canon law and worthy of death.
Right.
Here's another... Are you with me there?
Yeah.
So here's another parallel. In Islam, they have what are called jihads.
Right.
And a jihad is a holy war. In Romanism, you have what are called crusades. They are holy wars. Same exact thing. In Islam, you have a man of blood founding Islam, Muhammad, very immoral man, had many wives, illiterate. There's a book written, available by Chick Publications, who talks of a former Muslim who truly converted to Christ and born again. He tells the true story about Muhammad, and you can get that from Chick Publications. But in Islam, you have Muhammad founding Islam, at least openly, and in Romanism, you have Constantine founding Roman Catholicism.
Right.
Remember, Roman Catholicism doesn't exist one day prior to 325 AD.
Right.
Roman Catholicism was created at the Council of Nicaea through Constantine. So you have this parallel between Muhammad, Constantine, heretic, infidel, heretic, jihad, crusade. They have central cities. With Romanism, you have Rome as a central city. In Islam, you have Mecca as a central city. So these parallels are identical, and we should not be surprised, therefore, because the papacy existed almost 300 years before Islam. Islam was founded in 610 AD. Mm-hmm. Romanism was founded in 325. The first pope is Siricius, and about 399 he's called pope. But the first pope to be given universal spiritual power was in 606 with Gregory. So you have the establishment of Romanism with all of its beginning powers and universal spiritual power over every human creature 4 years before the founding of Islam. And the papacy could not reach to Arabia to carry out its decrees. So it created what is called the second sun. Islam is the second sun, really, of the devil. And so Islam, being an extension of Romanism, it would carry out the essential doctrines of Rome under the guise of another religion.
Interesting. And, you know, the question, of course, is, and you brought this up, why, because, again, on the surface, for someone who is, you know, new to a subject like this, it can't get it through, you know, why would the Vatican be instrumental in creating an enemy of the Christian faith? Because that goes, you know, obviously against logic. But what you were saying, Aaron, to clarify that again, is that they're using this in order to create this dichotomy, if you will, of these warring factions. And in such a war with such huge battles going on, you can consequently control populations better. You can kill off a lot of people that you're basically you want to get rid of. Is that correct, Eric?
That's correct. And the other thing we want to remember is we always must just define true Bible-based Christianity as those people who believe that the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, died for their sins according to their scriptures, was buried and rose again and coming back. And the Bible is the final authority for faith and practice of a true Christian. Romanism, on the other hand, has never been Christian. It is not Christian. It will never be Christian. It is papal mystery Babylon religion, as I show in this CD that's available that I mentioned. So Romanism is not Christian. Only true Bible-believing people who hold the Bible as their final authority of faith and practice, like the old Lutheran Church that was so prevalent in Sweden, which gave the Swedish people victory during the 30 Years' War led by the great Gustavus Adolphus. That kind of Bible-based Christianity that Gustavus adhered to was what made a nation great. So we must always distinguish between pagan Romanism and Bible-based, true, primitive, first century, and Reformation Christianity.
Mm. You know, one other thing that comes up, as a consequence to this, the reason why I wanted to address the background potentially of this is that this has progressed and continued up into our time, so to speak. We have, of course, something called the Muslim Brotherhood, and there's many authors that have written about the connections between the Muslim Brotherhood, the Nazis, and even progressing up from that up to Al-Qaeda. Have you looked into these connections as well, Eric?
Sure. To first talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, you must talk about the Masonic Grand Orient Lodge of Cairo and Istanbul. Those two lodges in the Near East are the most powerful Muslim lodges. Out of the Grand Lodge in Cairo comes the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Black Pope, the Jesuit general who controls the White Pope, Pope Benedict XVI, it's the Black Pope through his army of Jesuits that controls all Freemasonry, be it Scottish Rite in the West or Grand Orient in the East, and therefore he controls all the leaders out of Grand Orient Freemasonry, which include the Islamic leaders. For example, Saddam Hussein was one. Another one was King Hussein of Jordan. Another one was Ataturk of Turkey. Another one is Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. All these Muslim leaders are high-level Grand Orient Freemasons, and thus they are controlled by the Vatican. So the Masonic connection to the Muslim Brotherhood can never be overlooked. Second of all, we know that after World War II, that many of your top Nazis were brought out of Europe by means of the Jesuits using their Vatican rat lines, also called the Odessa. And many of these top Nazis went into the Near East. They went into Egypt. Dirlewanger, who was one of the heads of the Einsatz groupies in the East, he went into Cairo. And then you have a couple who went into Damascus. But you have these high Nazi SS officers that have gone down into these Muslim nations and aided and abetted and been helpful in establishing the Muslim Brotherhood. We have the PLO. The PLO is led by Yasser Arafat. His uncle was Haji Amin al-Husseini. He was a Freemasonic, a hoodlum, a Muslim, who was made the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem by Herbert Samuel. And Herbert Samuel was a Masonic Jew in England, in Britain, and because Britain had command of that land, breaking up the Ottoman Empire after World War I, they set up all their puppets in the new countries that they created. And one of their puppets for the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was Haji Amin al-Husseini. He was a Freemason. So the Jesuits in control of Britain and America for the entire duration of the 20th century set up all these Muslim leaders who were high-level Freemasons, secretly subordinate to the Pope.
Now, Eric, explain to us again and clarify for us the connection there between Freemasonry and the Vatican, because again, on the surface, a lot of people looking at this, they recognize the most of the Freemasonic brands, it's more clinging to a Protestant faction than to a Catholic one. But explain that for us, and what is the connection there?
okay, the remember that the Vatican always has an outward policy, but it is false. And then it has a secret policy, and that is the true policy. So the open policy of the papacy has, for the last 200 years at least, been anti-Masonic. That no Roman Catholic, at least till John Paul II made it okay for Roman Catholics to join the Lodge, but that no Roman Catholic could join the Masonic Lodge or else he would be excommunicated.
Yeah, yeah.
That was, are you with me there?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the open policy, or was the open policy, of the Vatican till John Paul II. The real policy is that the Jesuits wrote the first 25 degrees of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in 1754 in the College of Clermont in France, Paris, France. I have that documented from a Masonic source, and it's in my book. So the Jesuits, in creating Scottish Rite, the first 25 degrees, they then created the eight rites after that with Frederick the Great, when Frederick the Great, who was the head Freemason on the continent, protected the Jesuit order when Pope Clement suppressed the Jesuits with a papal bull in 1773, abolishing and extinguishing the Society of Jesus forever. And so it was Frederick II, or the Great, of Prussia, and it was Catherine II, the Great, of Russia, who were these two monarchs protecting the Jesuits during their 41-year suppression from 1773 to 1814. And during this time, the Jesuits were the masters of high-level Freemasonry, and they used their Grand Orient Masonic Lodge, in particular, on the continent, to foment and ignite the French Revolution.
Right.
And in igniting the French Revolution with Robespierre, who was Jesuit trained, the Jesuits then eliminated thousands of their enemies, including many Dominican priests, and then they brought Napoleon Bonaparte to power from Corsica.
Yeah.
And the Jesuits had been suppressed by the Pope. They had been expelled from South America. So some 2,000 Jesuits had been sent back from South America, from Paraguay and the holdings of Portugal and Spain, because the Portuguese and the Spanish monarchs suppressed them out of their countries and out of all their holdings. So some 2,000 Jesuits were sent back to Rome, and they then populated the island of Corsica off the coast of France. Well, it's no coincidence that Napoleon would arise from Corsica. So Napoleon was the great avenger for the Jesuit order in punishing the Roman Catholic monarchs of Europe for suppressing the Jesuits, for punishing the Pope, for imprisoning Pius VII for 5 years until he would agree to restore the Jesuit order in 1814. And they also used Napoleon for the destruction of many Protestants in Germany, to destroy the Protestant Dutch Republic in 1806. The Jesuits accomplished many things with their great avenger, Napoleon Bonaparte, only to then ultimately betray him and poison him at St. Helena. But the connection to Freemasonry is this, that Napoleon Bonaparte was a French Grand Orient Lodge Freemason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And his advisor, the second consul on the consulate, was Abbe Sayas, and Abbe Sayas was a Jesuit. So all the entire war maneuvers of Napoleon Bonaparte were dictated by Abbe Sayas. Sayas was on the directory, and then he was the second consul on the consulate, the first consul being Napoleon. So this connection of Masonry to the Jesuits is undeniable, and this is also a connection to the Pope's Masonic Jewish Labor Zionists, running Israel today, that they too are totally controlled by the papacy, by the Black Pope, through his control of Freemasonry.
Hmm.
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore. And we hope to see you live again in August next week. Inshallah.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm thinking back of the perfect kind of mix or blend, if you will, between Catholicism and Protestantism. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Anglican Communion that they have in the UK. I mean, some of the first United Grand Lodges were actually, you know, if you will, formed at the churchyard of St. Paul's Cathedral. And this was during the time that, you know, and this continues to this day, of course, the British Church, or the Church of England, is what is known as the Anglican Communion. What's your take on that? And is that a merge between the two?
Yes, the Jesuits have used Freemasonry to bring back all the Protestant sects. They've done it with the Presbyterians, with the Orange Lodge in Scotland. They've done it with the Dutch Reform, with lodges in Holland. They've done it in England with their Grandmother Lodge in London there. And you see Masonic power all throughout the old city of London. And just as an aside, we cannot forget that the Jesuits have controlled England since no later than King George III, that's 1760. That all the foreign policy of the English government has been pro-Rome, pro-papacy, anti-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, anti-true British Protestant people since no later than 1760. The United States has been controlled by the papacy since no later than 1860, with the beginning, ultimate beginning of the war between the states in 1861. So all the domestic policy and all the foreign policy of the United States, which I call in my book the Holy Roman 14th Amendment Corporate Fascist Socialist Communist American Empire, created in 1868 on July 28th with the declaring of the fourteenth Amendment to have been passed. With the creation of this empire, the American Empire has been nothing but the hammer of the Pope to subdue all nations to the temporal power of the Pope with a series of other purposes. So the way that the papacy has brought this is about is by using their high Freemasons to run America and their high Freemasons to run England to ultimately bring all sects back to the papacy.
What about this expansion of the Anglo-American Empire? A lot of other authors are looking into this fact that, with the wars, of course, we can take the most recent Iraq and Afghani war that is going on right now. That this is an attempt by the British and American Empire, if you will, to try to dominate and control the world. Is that just a front, you think?
That's a front. It's the same kind of front that Hitler was accused of. That Hitler wants to conquer the world. He's going to come to America and conquer the world. That Hitler wants to have a thousand-year Reich. That's all a front. That's all a propaganda lie. That's the open but false policy of the Vatican. The true policy of Hitler was to purge as many Jews out of Europe as possible, was to be involved in the creation or the recreation of the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, which we call Israel, and I defend the Jews' right to their land, of course, but I do not defend the government that runs that country.
Yeah.
And also the purpose of Adolf Hitler was to kill as many heretic Orthodox people as possible. And on the other hand, on the flip side, then, because the Jesuits were controlling Stalin and Hitler and FDR and Churchill all together, they were all working together, then after towards the end of the war, the Jesuits were going to incite the Red Army to rape, pillage, and plunder the Protestant Prussian people to the end that Berlin is destroyed, all the Protestant cities of Germany are destroyed, some 72 cities were bombed to smithereens, and so they were destroying the Lutheran Protestant Prussians and Germans in Germany, as well as destroying as many Jews out of Europe, as well as destroying Rotterdam, destroying as many Protestant cities as possible, the bombing of Hull and Coventry in England. So it was a tremendous pincer movement on behalf of the Jesuits controlling both sides, to the end now that Hitler never really wanted an empire. He hated the German people. He betrayed them many times. He ordered the bombing of Protestant cities by the Luftwaffe. He also ordered the German people to go down in the underground sewers to evade bombing, only to flood them and drown thousands of them. So Hitler was out to destroy the British people, or the German people, under the guise of creating an empire.
Right.
Well, the same thing's being done here. Under the guise of we're going to make the world safe for democracy.
Right.
Under that lying propaganda, what is happening is this government in this empire is busy creating the world as the enemy for the American people, particularly the historic white Anglo-Saxon Protestant American peoples. And so that every nation in the world will be our enemy because of this foreign policy of Washington controlled by the Pope. And at the same time, this is not a war of expansion, creating an empire. It's a war of annihilation. It's a war of annihilating the Shia Muslims, because the Shia, in differing between the Sunnis, the leaders of the Shia, or the leader of the Shia, is considered to be infallible. He's considered to be divine. Unlike the Sunni leader, he is considered a mere temporal lord. So there can be no man on the face of the earth that is considered infallible or divine except the Pope. Therefore, we have to destroy the peoples that would seek to make this man or follow this man as though he is divine.
You know, I'm thinking about Skull and Bones, George W., the boy Bush. If he, and of course his administration, there's a lot of people behind that guy and so forth, we know that, but do you think that they are just pawns in this game that are kind of willingly playing along, or do they have full knowledge of that they're actually destroying the empire, or do you think that they actually, you know, believe that they're helping to rebuild, you know, and strengthen America?
No, they have full knowledge they're destroying it. That's why they've shut down all of our oil wells. They've shut down Gull Island on the Aleutian Chain in Alaska. It has more oil than all of Saudi Arabia. There's enough oil for 200 years. They've shut down Prudhomme Bay to us. If we had Prudhomme Bay and Gull Island, we would never need one drop of foreign oil ever again. They've deliberately shut it down, and the master of this topic is Lindsay Williams in his book, The Energy Non-Crisis. So they have deliberately made America, North America, dependent on foreign oil, specifically Middle Eastern oil, so that trillions of American dollars or Federal Reserve notes can be siphoned off over there for the benefit of the papacy, because one of their goals is the rebuilding of Babylon.
There you go. That is very interesting because, of course, you know, many people are looking at the Iraq war that's all about oil. But what you're saying is that also is another ruse. That's another front that people on the first level down into the conspiracy, so to speak, can get trapped within, if you will. Is that right?
That's right. This great conspiracy is not economic. It is not political. It is religious. Everything is religion because of the mystery Babylon religion that is essentially popery. And so everything they do is based on a mystery Babylon, pagan Roman Catholic reason. And one of the things they want to do, as controlled by the Jesuits, because remember the Black Pope controls the papacy, is the rebuilding of the ancient city of Babylon, and the beginning of its building is Dubai.
Really?
So that's correct. Dubai is the beginning of rebuilding of the ancient area called Babylon, and the treasure city, the huge commercial treasure city of Babylon, according to Jeremiah 58:51, Revelation 18, Isaiah 14, Babylon must be rebuilt because the ancient Babylon was never destroyed as the Bible says this has to be destroyed. The Bible says the city of Babylon has to be destroyed in 1 hour by fire. Well, ancient Babylon was never destroyed. So therefore, there must be a Babylon to be rebuilt in the future that will be destroyed this specific way. And so therefore, we are beginning to see the building of ancient Babylon. America is going to be in Iraq for many, many more decades. They're building the largest embassy in the world there in the Green Zone. Mm-hmm. There's 14 American bases there. There is no intention of leaving for a long, long time because it's a war of annihilation against the Shia Muslims, to the end that when this is finished, when this papal crusade is finished, then the Vatican will be able to begin to rebuild its commercial capital of the world, which will be situated on the Euphrates River, the ancient city of Babylon.
And you mentioned Dubai. That's very interesting, I think, because a lot of progress, so to speak, has been going on down there. And I mean, the city, some of the cities that they're building up are just, you know, they're incredible, actually, if you look at them. So I've seen some picture of it.
It's incredible.
It is.
Absolutely. And, excuse me?
Yeah, no. I was just going to say that they're building some of the, I don't know if you've seen these. These are like islands they're building right out in the ocean. These are kind of miniatures of the world. This is like a mini map, actually, of the world where we have condos and things on there. It's like a city. And there's numerous things that they're doing. You know, they're bringing in kind of new technology type cities that are intelligently controlled. You have an RFID infrastructure throughout the entire city. You know, this is incredible.
Yeah, and according to the Bible, Babylon, the city of Babylon, will be the commercial center for the coming Antichrist, for the coming beast, who I show in my book, is a coming pope, the final pope who will be killed. He will come back to life. He will destroy the Vatican with the 10 military kings that he has in Europe. And then he'll not only go down to Jerusalem to the third temple and set his image there, which can talk and speak by the power of his false prophet, but he will also go to his treasure city of Babylon, and it is there that will be the universal commercial center where everyone will be commanded to take his name, his mark, or his number. And the control for all of this will be out of the ancient city of Babylon, rebuilt.
Interesting indeed. If we talk about the Iraq war and some of the things that have been going on there, one of the things, of course, that is a huge scandal almost a year ago now, or even more, I can't remember, the Blackwater scandal, right? We have the former CEO, Joseph E. Schmitz, who were, of course, has connections to both Skull and Bones and Knights of Malta, as I understand it. Is that correct, Eric?
I'm not sure about Skull and Bones. I don't know about that. I haven't seen that, but he is a Knight of Malta. His father was a Knight of Columbus. And so Joseph Schmitz, who is on the board of Blackwater, remember also that he resigned from the Pentagon as an inspector because he was told to investigate Blackwater. So rather than investigate Blackwater, he resigns and he goes to the board of Eric Prince.
Right.
Eric Prince was a Dutch Reformed. He converted to Roman Catholicism. And so Blackwater is nothing but a 21st century band of crusaders controlled by the Knights of Malta in this crusade against these infidel Muslims, quote-unquote, justifying their mass murder. And that's what's going on in Iraq right now. It is a mass murder of men, women, and children who are Shiites, who the Pope has targeted as a threat to his temporal and spiritual power, unlike the Sunnis. In fact, the Sunnis are helping the American military and American government annihilate the Shia.
And yet on the front, of course, outwardly in the press, in the media, so forth, Pope Ratzinger, as I call him, is, of course, denouncing the Iraq war, right? He's telling that all the things that are going on there is horrible. Yet he has these underlings from the Knights of Malta prominently involved in both the invasion and the consequent presence in Iraq. So that's, it's a double standard right there, correct?
That's right. See, when you examine the facts, you see that the papacy is totally behind it. When you listen to its rhetoric, you know he's a liar, because the Pope is the biggest liar in the world. His lies kill millions of people. And so he is outwardly saying this is not our war. But if he doesn't want the war, all he would have to do is order his Cardinal Secretary of State to make one phone call to the Papal Nuncio in Washington, and that Papal Nuncio make one phone call to George Bush and tell him to end this war. And George Bush would set in motion the machinery to end this war whenever the Pope wants it ended. That's the kind of power the Pope has.
Right, right.
Furthermore, we know that 9/11 was an inside job. For anybody, any thinking individual to believe that 9/11 was not an inside job, he's not evaluating the facts.
Right.
And I would strongly recommend for your listeners to review Loose Change number 2. But there are many other good presentations on it. But the inside job of 9/11 involved the organized intelligence community of the United States. It all works together. If that's the case, the question is, who was in charge of that organized intelligence community on 9/11?
Yeah.
And that answer is one man, George J. Tenet.
Right.
George J. Tenet, as you probably already know, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes.
The Council on Foreign Relations is America's secret government based out of New York City, begun in 1921, and its overseer is the Archbishop of New York City, today Edward Cardinal Egan. George J. Tenet is also a Knight of Malta. He was educated at the Jesuit School of Foreign Service, founded by Edmund Walsh. Edmund Walsh was the most powerful American Jesuit from 1922 to 1952. He controlled Eisenhower. He controlled FDR. He controlled Truman. through the entire duration of the war. Edmund Walsh is the most powerful American Jesuit during this, what I call the Second 30 Years War from 1914 to 1945. And he's also a Knight of Malta. So here we have George J. Kennedy, he's a Knight of Malta. He is tutored by the School of Foreign Service started by Edmund Walsh. He is a member of the CFR. He's beloved of the new president of Georgetown University in Washington. That new president is not a Jesuit. He is a Knight of Malta, John de Goya, and he's also a CFR member. So when you add it all together, it was Archbishop Egan of New York City who ordered 9/11. It was carried out by DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, George J. Tenet, who was also a national security advisor. And then to cover his tracks and make him not the center point of any attention, he resigns from the CIA.
Mm.
So that's how they cover their tracks in this. So this is a papal crusade started by the Knights of Malta, carried out by the Knights of Malta, and when the Vatican makes John McCain president of this country, his campaign manager at this time is another Knight of Malta. So they're fully intending to continue this crusade, and they're going to do a few more things in this country that are going to be to justify the continuation of it.
And so what you're saying is that this was used, 9/11 then, this was used as a catalyst to enter into the Middle East again and start up another holy crusade, right?
That's right. This is just as much of a crusade as the nine crusades during the Dark Ages. And this crusade is, of course, oil is involved. That's the cover, and making money for Halliburton and other major corporations controlled by the Knights of Malta, because they're not only going to kill off this Shia population, they're going to make billions of dollars for themselves and also pave the way for the rebuilding of Babylon. But the other thing is they're going to secure Israel, which they call the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. Now, as I cover on my CD, the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem began in 1099 and it ended in 1291. Mm. And the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem was intended by the Pope to be his place of universal worship, but in the providence of God, the Pope really never got power over that kingdom.
Mm.
So what happened was, with the end of the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem in 1291, then the Vatican wanted to have another crusade or so, but they always wanted to take it back, but they never could. So therefore, during World War I, the Jesuits used the British Empire, the Protestant British Empire, to then destroy the Ottoman Empire, which was aided and abetted by the Ottoman Sultan, Hamid, I believe, the fifth. And they took Jerusalem from the Muslims, and that was the beginning of being able to rebuild the temple there in the Temple Mount. And that was the beginning of reestablishing the Pope's Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. So this crusade will kill off many millions of Muslim enemies to the maintaining of the nation of Israel, so that the Pope can build Solomon's Temple there on the Temple Mount, as we know that in 1993, the Pope's Masonic Jewish Labor Zionist deeded the mount, that holy site, to the Vatican in September. And in December, the Vatican formally recognized the nation of Israel.
Right.
So that's the purpose for this crusade, I'm totally believe. And the other thing is, they're going to bring in tons and tons of gold out of the central banks that they've hoarded away from the people. And they're going to make this third temple an unbelievable eighth wonder of the world.
Right,
For that to happen, there can be no bombers. There can be no Palestinian bombers to upset the building of this, so all of those people have to be removed.
Hmm. And this is going to be, of course, done or veiled in this disguise that now we have attained world peace, finally. The earth is safe, right? And now a new era begins of a thousand year of peace for mankind. That's what I kind of see on the horizon. What about
Europe? That's right. That's their propaganda.
Right. And, of course, we can discuss some of the aftermath here again of 9/11 and discuss some of the things that happened in the U.S., of course. We can talk about the chief architect of the USA Patriot Act, Viet D. Dinh. Tell us about him, Eric.
Well, Viet Dinh is a Vietnamese Roman Catholic, and he comes from a noble family in Vietnam, as did President Diem during the Vietnam War. He is also a professor, or an adjunct professor, I believe, at Georgetown University, and he was also a deputy director, of the Justice Department. Assistant Attorney General, that's what he was, Assistant Attorney General. And so this guy at Georgetown University writes the Patriot Act of somewhat 200 pages that's immediately in place, ready to be introduced right after 9/11.
Right.
And not one American congressman read it. Not one. So they passed this thing under the guise of keeping America safe, blah, blah, blah. And now what we have is the real beginnings of the overthrow of our Fourth Amendment right, our Fifth Amendment right, the implementation of fascism, because the Jesuits have sought to bring a fascist military dictator to power here in America since no later than the 1930s, with the quest of John J. Raskob and other Knights of Malta to overthrow, quote-unquote, FDR, and to implement this dictatorship under a dictatorship.
Let's talk a little bit about Georgetown University. For people that might not know, this comes up, you know, again and again in your work. Definitely in Vatican Assassins, we see people that attend this university and go there and teach there and so forth. Does this, if someone goes to Georgetown University or teaches there, does that automatically mean that that person, you know, is a Jesuit or endorses that particular theology / philosophy, or even is of Catholic stock?
Generally, not necessarily. Most of the people that go there think they're just getting a good education, which is true. But those on the faculty, they know the power of the Jesuit order. And they, if they have watched what's going on, know the direction of things. And they also know that the president, Supreme Court justices, powerful senators and congressmen all meet at Georgetown University on a regular basis to discuss foreign policy, domestic policy, and so on. So it doesn't take a real bright individual to see, if they're a professor, that Georgetown University is the capital of the United States. Hmm. It's only some 4 miles away from, Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
So the Jesuits control all foreign and all domestic policy from the West Wing of the White House, added by the Roosevelt conspirators. And then that foreign policy is dictated by the Jesuits from Georgetown, as fine-tuned by their think tank called the Council on Foreign Relations. That's how the American government runs.
Right, right. And, you know, I think we need to begin to round things up here for this segment. I want to again ask you to give out your website address so people know how they can get a copy of your book, either in ebook form or the hardback, I guess, and also tell us again about that PowerPoint CD that you have available for people.
Yes. Okay, to get the CD, the book CD, the ebook, it's 40 Federal Reserve Notes plus shipping, and that's 1,836 pages that you can view on a computer, or you can get the book. We printed 100 of them. We have about 40 of them sold, so we have about 60 more to go. Depending on how it sells, will depend on whether or not I print any more of them. And you can get the book for $325 Federal Reserve Notes plus shipping. And then you can also get the PowerPoint CD. Now, for your listeners in Sweden, I think the book's a waste of money, because all you got to do is get the CD, and then you can take the CD to your own printer in Sweden and have them print it out, and you would pay less for them to print out the book then you would have to pay for buying the book and shipping it to Sweden. So I would recommend get the CD for only $40, then print it out in book form, then you have the book, and then you get the PowerPoint CD for $20, and then that brings you up to snuff as far as Romanism being mystery Babylon religion, Romanism's its control of Islam, the Inquisition, the starting of the Jesuits controlling Bohemian Grove, all the way to this present crusade, the purposes for Islam, the Jesuits' intent for the destruction of the Orthodox people like Serbia. All of that's tied into this extensive CD. It will take you 2.5 hours to view it. But with that in conjunction with the book CD or the ebook, you will have the whole package, a wonderful workbook, so to say, that you can then build on your knowledge as you discover new facts. So it keeps the reader up to snuff. And then I have my newsletter that you can get for 40 Federal Reserve notes a year, which is every other month, bi-monthly. And then I'll have pictures and new articles and feature certain men of power and politics that are controlled by the Jesuits so we can understand where they are going and what they desire to do.
The website again is VaticanAssassins.org. Do check it out. We're going to take a short break here and then continue talking more in our member section about Knights of Malta, the EU, and people behind the EU. We're going to talk about the server.
Despite our best efforts, shortages of marijuana are now being reported.
Joining me because the message this evening is not my message, but ours. Despite our best efforts, shortages of marijuana are now being reported. From the early days of our administration, Nancy has been using marijuana on a daily basis, and her personal observations and efforts have given her such dramatic insights that I wanted her to share them with you this evening.
I yearn to find a way to help share the message that drugs open your eyes to life, to see it in the vivid colors that God gave us.
And drug abuse is not a crime. And in the most important area, individual use, we see progress. The U.S. military has more than tripled the use of drugs among its personnel since 1980. And there's one more thing. Nancy and I are hooked on heroin. Our goal is to expand drug trafficking at all levels of government and in the private sector. Help us.
Sounds like it's having a hallucinogenic effect, not like a drug which is harmful and wrong and just say no, kids, but spacey nonetheless. Just say no, kids. Just say no, kids. Just say no, kids.
I yearn to find a way to help share the message that Drugs open your eyes to life, to see it in the vivid colors that God gave us. I yearn to find a way to help share the message. Drugs open your eyes to life, to see it in the vivid colors that God gave us.
Sounds like a 7-year-old hallucinogenic effect.
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore, and we hope to see you live again in August next week, inshallah.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the News Paste podcast with me, Johnny Vedmore. My guest today has been a thorn in the side of those who write our official history books for a long time now. And like other researchers and journalists who are inspecting the official narrative, he tends to find the answers from around during World War II and the post-war formation of what we describe as a new world order and all its many tentacles. When I first spoke with Tony Gosling, I was very much at the start of my own journey towards becoming a semi-professional, I'd say, independent investigative journalist. And if I was to look back at all of his work then, I fear that much of it would have gone over my head. However, today, times have changed, because after years of research, I understand that many of the events Tony covers are actually marked the birth of our current political world order, the building blocks that make the what we see today, made what we see today possible. So welcome, Tony Gosling, to the News Paste podcast. I'm happy to have you on.
Oh, thanks, Johnny. Thanks very much for asking me.
Oh, well, it's. I mean, I think our paths were always meant to cross to some sort of extent. It's so difficult. When I first started out, I was I'm not sure which direction to go in. I was constantly moving from one area to another, trying to find the articles and the stories that made sense of things to other people. But I didn't have so much in the way of sense of a proportion and scale and historical understanding of what had actually happened at the time. And of course, it was really my looking into Klaus Schwab's history, his family history, discovering about his father's work for the Nazis, and then his joining of a CIA-funded program to train young global leaders out of Harvard called Kissinger's International Seminar, and everything that come from that. It's kind of that's led me to really have to go back to the stage where you're at. And everybody, as I get closer, everybody's screaming not only your name, but names like Bormann and etc. And you're obviously the expert. So how did you get here?
Well, look, just to start with, this is a grooming program you're talking about, which was instituted really around about the time of World War II to tap up young, often sons and daughters of powerful criminals of various sorts in order to make them the new leaders. So the idea is it's almost like a kind of genetic we want our kids to be the great leaders of tomorrow. We're criminals, but, you know, you can't, obviously, as Schwab's father was involved in the Nazi nuclear program, and which a lot of people try and forget about. But it was, you know, if you think about the logic of it all, the atom was split in Berlin just before World War II. I mean, all the experts were in Hungary and Eastern Europe and Germany. So, of course, they're going to have a nuclear program. and what you've described, your experience of sort of stepping out of this, shall we say, comfortable bubble of what we're supposed to believe. In fact, a lot of it is very uncomfortable on a subconscious level. Yeah. You find this like a minefield, a conspiracy minefield, I'd describe it, with all sorts of extremely powerful, important, true, real conspiracies, peppered with a whole load of total and utter deliberate rubbish. Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of barrier for many people. They think, well, look, I mean, I just don't have the time or the headspace to go through all this. And this is where one specific book really comes in handy. And you won't be surprised here, it's not mine. It's a book by David Southwell called Secrets and Lies. Mm-hmm. Now, David is, an old mate of mine. I mean, we've had our differences over the years. He's now, I think he's kind of gotten into the London establishment for our benefit rather than for his own. But anyway, he was very seriously ill for a while. David's pedigree was writing a book called The History of Organized Crime, which, of course, is a fascinating topic. And it's a very, very good book looking at mainly UK, but obviously America.
Links up well to intelligence agencies, seeing as they basically morphed into being the same thing at some point.
Well, yes, and drug dealing and funny money and banking. And I mean, one of the stories he tells in there is about Charlie Richardson, one of the South London gangsters who finally, under Harold Wilson in the 1970s, was jailed. And when he came out of jail after something 7 years or something in prison in the 1980s, he walked straight into a job in the City of London.
Isn't that the way? Yes.
And this is the world we're in now. Is there's no need to go robbing banks, you know, because obviously all the criminals are now running and controlling them. And as we've seen with the cancellation, I was just hearing today of Debbie Hicks, who's one of the campaigners in the south of England around cash, for example, though she travels all around the country now. She's had her bank accounts shut down. We had Nigel Farage having his bank accounts shut down, this sort of thing. So the banksters are just sending messages to all of us. Look, this is actually a religion. You don't even realize you're part of it. Money is a religion. It's an act of faith. And we're slowly asserting our power and control over you because we are the high priests in that religion, these bankers. And then we have Michael Tyler a few years ago. It's about 4 years ago. Michael's a blogger that lives on a canal boat. And he's one of those brilliant journos that has just decided, right, I'm going to look into this story. And it was him that came up with this list of over 100 dead bankers. This is about 2017, 2018, 2019, during that period. A whole load of bankers just committed suicide, as you would if you're a super rich person, shooting themselves in the head twice and electrocuting themselves in the bath. So there was an absolute massacre of bankers at the time. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, these are ones that are not part of the cult, you know, that are running. Anyway, David's book, Secrets and Lies, is a sort of coffee table thing, but it's like salvation to anybody in your situation, Johnny, where you're thinking, where do I start? You know, because he's got a page, every page has got another conspiracy, which he gives you enough information in there, some lovely glossy pictures too, of how to check for yourself. And he says right at the start, look, don't believe me. I've just dug all this information out. Anyway, he's done a beautiful job with that. And I think it helps anybody that's in the same sort of situation as I was originally when I left the BBC. And you obviously were, after we first, pretty much the time we first spoke, Johnny, to get your head around and navigate that minefield.
Yeah, and obviously we're all on our own journeys, and you've come from what me and others would say establishment media, but you've seen that there's a load of there's a whole curtain to draw back, and that they're not drawing back that curtain at all. Instead, it's left for these other researchers, and I don't think people understand the power of the gentleman you were just talking about, who's written Secret and Lies. What was his name again? Sorry,
David Southwell.
Well, I obviously got to know David Southwell, because that's the type of thing that I'm desperate for. I'm desperate for people to give me the idea of where to look without it being, oh, look, this is the most popular topic or a really popular topic that we all want to know about. more about, even though we know everything about it. We just want you to go there because it's the only thing we know. It's actually in between the lines of the popular topics where all of the truth is, where all of the real stuff is happening. And I suppose as well, I've had a lot of research recently. I've done a lot of research into that era that you kind of talked about in London, where the gangsters were about, and the changeover from gangsters merging with intelligence. Basically, through the late 50s, I researched in the same way that you're talking about bankers dying there. I researched I found out that over a year and a half, a string of women who own nightclubs in the most poshest part of London all died in all mysterious ways. And then all of those clubs were taken over by all of the gangsters and intelligence linked mobsters that would eventually be, would all be betrayed by the intelligence or become intelligence. And this would eventually lead to things like the Claremont set and the people in London, like the clubs in London, which ran the show. You know, this was the birth of that, the gangsters and the intelligence, the gangsters realizing that they could not beat intelligence and they had to join them. And I think we see a lot of this all trying to understand how, where to look there. I was asked to go and look into the craze and the ownership of Esmeralda's Barn. And now everybody knows about the craze, but as soon as you start looking at something like Esmeralda's Barn, a nightclub in London that no one really knows about, but had a lot of activity back then, and you start researching it, you discover there's a whole world. And it's all, it's like a lot of it is known, but it's forgotten. And so,
yeah, but I think it's Johnny, at the time, a lot of this stuff was getting reported. It was splashed on the tabloid press. And one of the things I think very, very few people understand is the change that happened in our press between the 1970s and the 1990s, really through the Thatcher era. I mean, we're now dealing with the privatization of water, aren't we? You know, and all the things that Thatcher sold off, now owned by Chinese companies who just want to milk us for everything they can, you know. So it's like the Romans over in Beijing, we're having to pay tribute to them. So, I mean, it was a complete disaster, Thatcherism. But what people don't understand is that battle that happened in Wapping with the print unions and the journalists unions and Rupert Murdoch and obviously Eddie Shah, various other media moguls, was so important. I mean, I interviewed for a journalist union oral history project here in Bristol, some of the journalists who've been working right through since the Second World War, who were retiring. And it was fascinating to hear their take on this as journalists was that we had a relationship with printers. We got paid by the proprietor, but our relationship was with the printers and the editor. And so they would get commissioned to do stories. They'd sometimes just dig out their own stories. They were left very much to their own, trusted to get on with the job. And what people don't understand is the complete difference that happened with the computerization and that Murdoch was doing in Wapping. I was gobsmacked to hear this, but the journalists were saying, this particular guy was saying, we used to take send the copy down to the print room, and then we get a phone call from downstairs. Okay, the page is made up now. So as a journalist, usually late in the afternoon or in the evening, we'd go down into the print room to check our story, and the printer, and there was a line right between the printing machine and where the journalist was allowed to stand, and they would read their story backwards that had been typeset in hot metal, and they'd read the story, check it, and sign the story off. So the journalist union and the print union were the only people between the story and the public, if you see what I mean. So the editor really didn't get involved. You had subs obviously doing headlines, and layout of the page was really controlled by subs. But it was a very, very trusted thing that the unions enforced in a draconian way, right? So they understood the journalists must get their information to the public via a printer, and we're not having anyone messing around with it. So that was what got broken by Murdoch, that whole system. I mean, obviously the print unions were basically destroyed, the journalist union, NUJ, is still there. And so for example, with the 7/7 London bombings, there was a, I mean, I found this fact, these little anomalies I find absolutely fascinating. So Mark Honigsbaum on The Guardian was down at the London bombings in 2005, and he recorded a little podcast for The Guardian website outside Edgware Road in Marks and Spencer's, where there were a lot of people who'd come out from the bombings and were kind of, you know, in M&S, kind of getting cups of tea and things like that. And so he'd spoken to them, and he did a little podcast on the day. Anyway, the next day's paper, the day after the bombings, is an article by Mark Honigsbaum appears in The Guardian. The only thing is it contradicts what he said the day before. So the day before he says the bombs were under the trains, and he says it twice in his little podcast. Mm-hmm. This is what people were telling him as they were coming out. And then in the article in the newspaper, it says the bomb was inside the trains. And so about maybe it must be a month after the bombings, Johnny, I phoned him up at The Guardian. I said, Mark, what's how do you explain this difference between what you said on the day and your podcast and what appeared in the in your article the next day? And it was a brilliant sort of silence on the other end of the line. And he said, well, Tony, not everything I submit as copy appears in the next day's paper.
Boom. Yeah. Yeah. Someone else is deciding how to. That is a real. That is fundamentally editing a base level as low as close to the bone as you can go.
A terrorist attack in real time being interpreted. Another example is the Al Sadr newspaper in Iraq. There was a massive suicide bombing in Baghdad, and it was all over the world. Something like 20 people killed in a bus queue not long after Tony Blair's wonderful project and started. And in the Al Sadr newspaper in Iraq, their headline the next day was missile fired from helicopter. Right. So the eyewitnesses in Iraq had been saying there's a helicopter fired a missile into the bus queue, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's an American helicopter or a British helicopter. It's one of the occupying forces. There's nobody else allowed to fly in there. Just blew up a whole load of people in a bus queue. It might be there was one person in that queue that had some information that they wanted assassinated or executed.
Yeah, and
so we've had this story go all the way around the world. Isn't it terrible? A suicide bomb has done this in Baghdad, but actually on the ground there. And you know what happened the next day? As soon as that been published in the Al Sadr newspaper, the Bremer's American forces come in and shut the paper down.
They just
come into the offices, take all the computers, arrest everybody, release them bit by bit. But that newspaper is now out of circulation, out of action. There's a very great interest by the military and by the intelligence services in every single story. And this is just coming back to this week. Okay, so there was I don't know if you remember last week in Kramatorsk, in the war zone in eastern Ukraine, there was a bomb attack on a pizza restaurant. I don't know if you picked this one up, but
no, I didn't.
There were 12 people. So it was a missile attack by the Russians on a pizza restaurant, and this has gone all around the Western world in the press. Oh, isn't it evil Russians? They're just killing random people in pizza restaurants. Well, you start to look at the footage, and you can see there's all military people being helped out of the place. So there's obviously a few military, well, it's a war zone, so you'd expect that. And then on the BBC bulletin last Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, which I recorded, you've got they said in that bulletin, oh, and there were 4 British people injured. So you think to yourself, interesting. Let's see if we can find that on the internet anywhere. No. But so what are these 4 people doing there from Britain? Are they on holiday in the war zone? Are they lost? Have they managed to sort of stumble into Kramatorsk by mistake and decided, right, we don't know where we are, so let's go and get ourselves a pizza?
Been a long night.
So this is what I'm saying is that it is, I think in real time, the media is really strategically lying to us all the time now, particularly to do with the everything to do with Ukraine. The war there is utter. In fact, I even overheard some, I guess they would be military strategic communications people in a Morrison's cafe, as this was all started, sort of bragging about, you know, oh, we had some journalist that thought he could say what he wanted about this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just got him, we put him in his place. And they didn't actually say they got him sacked, but that's what they do.
A apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore. And we hope to see you live again in August next week. Inshallah.
They only got to get rid of the ones who have got a good enough voice and who are concise enough to be able to say their points and make their points salient enough to slip into the public rhetoric. There is a question that when I was listening to all of that was just rolling around in my head. I just could not stop thinking about it. Like, I wonder, and you're probably not going to have the answer, but I think we can both estimate them. I think we'll both know the answer. But compared to that scene you paint now in eastern Ukraine, in the war zone, and the people who are fighting in a war zone like that, compared to World War II, actual frontline World War II action, how many of the 100 random troops or 1,000 random troops would you say were heavily intelligence trained back in World War II compared to now? I'm wondering if it was actually like, you know, there's only 1 or 2% back then who had significant enough intelligence training. And nowadays, I wonder if there's actually more people on the ground who are intelligence than there are military fighters actually firing guns and attacking the other side. It seems to be that we are seriously, this fifth generation warfare is the whole thing. That nothing is as it seems anymore. And this Ukrainian war has been hyper normalization of the greatest guy. Some of the clips that you see on the news, it means that they're not even trying to hide that there's fakery going on. So I mean, how do you where are we? Where are we, Tony? You're well, a guy who's got a lot of experience in this.
Okay, there's lots of warfare everywhere, but it's like you say, there's a fantastic amount of money being ploughed into psychological warfare because it's been very successful in the past. I mean, it was during World War II and the D-Day landings that there was a Dennis Wheatley, the writer, was one of the major deception planners for that, making all these inflatable tanks so the German reconnaissance would see them classic. Think there was a massive force. And they succeeded there in pinning down five divisions for about 6 weeks, waiting for the invasion at Calais that never came. So this is an incredibly, incredibly effective piece of work. Mm-hmm. And they would argue, well, it's, you know, it's ethical because we weren't actually killing people, blah, blah. So they learned a lot from Wheatley. Although Wheatley is never talked about, he's completely taboo nowadays because he was a brilliant guy and a genius and a brilliant writer on the occult, you know, the sort of black magic and things like that. Mm-hmm. And just generally a very good historian. He did a couple of really good books. One is on the Russian Revolution, the history of that, and another one on the English Civil War, which is a terrific look at the history of what happened to mostly to do with Charles II, actually. Bit about Charles I, but the kings, you know, because they were basically
fantastic. It's fantastic.
I mean, you know, it's a bit of a rabbit hole, but the English Civil War was one of the most important things that ever happened. We don't really get talked about.
Okay, just before you say that, some of my audience know about this, and you may know about this. I don't know, but my father was Colonel John Birch of Colonel John Birch's regiment of foot. And I was brought up in the 17th century. I was in the sealed knot. So, my father, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, he set up Colonel John Birch's regiment of foot, 13 militia from, it was between 6,000 and 8,000, people who were members of the sealed knot then. And for people who don't understand what this is, campsite, loads of people partying all weekend, families turn up, caravans, etc. And then we all dress up in 17th century costumes, get our muskets on, get our swords out, get the armor on, put the pikes up in front and march off with drums, whistles, and water carriers galore. And there's real gunpowder and there's buzz, and they fight for in front of a spectacle for crowds of, I mean, my dad run musters that were like 16,000 people would turn up. And back then they were paying like £5-10 to get in. And it was a wonderful day of festivities, really good family stuff, watching like the reenactment of war outside various castles. Well, I spent every weekend doing that. So I explored the 17th century in ways that many people didn't, because my dad was so into it. He set up his own regiment, and that regiment ended up getting to about 250 people, regular people, who, I mean, these regiments were like close family then. You're recruiting friends. When you go to a seal knot campsite, you're all camped with your regiment in your tertio. So you get to know history in a different way. So I find the English Civil War amazing. And my history teacher used to force me, to bring in costumes and tell people about the English Civil War.
I think you have to take a sort of view from the moon of it, really, because the English Civil War was a battle between the feudal classes in England and the merchant classes. And it was started really by the City of London, and the war against Charles the First, it's interestingly we now got number three, of course, was initiated mainly because he had been overturning enclosures. So there have been enclosures, a lot of enclosures of land, privatisation of land, where people have been turfed out of their homes. You know, if you go around the countryside now, you often find the footings of these old houses from the 14th, 15th century, and small settlements, which were basically like massive allotments around the houses. So they started enclosing these villages, which was evicting the people and turning over the land over mostly to sheep. But anyway, it was a modern kind of form of farming. They called it modernization, but it ended up with lots of people being evicted. And Charles I started fining the landowners who'd been evicting people in the 1630s. And they didn't like it, because this was part of a plan and set off by John Dee in the Elizabethan era for a British empire. The idea was evict all these people. Let's start growing a massive surplus of food in an industrial scale, which is the agricultural revolution. Yeah. And let's get all these people to work in factories, building things like ships and guns.
Very similar to what happened in Ireland in the late 1700s and early 1800s as well.
So anyway, so the point is that the empire was planned. I don't really think Charles I quite understood or went along with the way the empire was supposed to be being built. And what he saw was loads of families, kids sleeping in ditches and things like this. And he's saying, no, you've got to stop this. These people are growing their own food. They're doing fine. They're producing a bit of a surplus. They're there for military service if we need them. And this is a system I don't want the merchant classes, the City of London, overturning. So eventually, you know, the empire did happen because we had there was a counter civil war with Charles II being brought back as king. But then after that, the Orange men won the day. The Masons won the day by bringing back in King Billy in the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 1600s. So they won. I mean, okay, so we had a few years. In fact, it was a brilliant time, the Restoration, Charles II. There was all these plays being performed in London where the establishment was lampooned. It was like amazing. It was like the 1960s, you know.
They run the banks into the ground as well, I think, during that period.
That's right. The Bank of England was set up after the Glorious Revolution. So beginning of the control of the people through money. But yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, I wrote in my book, if you're interested, is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is really, it's not my writings. It's an anthology that I put together. It starts really at the time of the English Civil War and looks at the plot, Cromwell's plot, along with, because he's characterized by Walter Scott, the great writer, historical novel, he invented the historical novel, as the bankrupt brewer of Huntingdon. Because apparently Cromwell had run a brewery in Huntingdon, and it's good that you're not.
Really? Are you talking about Oliver Cromwell?
Yes, Oliver Cromwell had run a brewery in Huntingdon, and he'd failed. I mean, this was the way that the royalists took the mickey out of him. They said he couldn't even run a brewery. Yeah, this guy, and it's one of the easiest ways to make money is you pour a load of malt, and then you ferment it, and you make loads of money out of it, and it's like free money. But Cromwell went bankrupt doing brewing, and so he was, but he was at kind of at a loss, and he was looking to kind of affirm himself amongst the great and the good and the powerful. So he was their tool, you know, during the war. Anyhow, so I digress a bit talking about Dennis Wheatley, but I think the English have really got to understand what went on there, because it set the stage for the empire. Very different to the American empire. I mean, we went around with Bibles and guns, and, you know, we had a bit more of a persuasive way. And also we were putting in water systems, things like that. You know, I'm not saying the British Empire was a great thing. It was we massacred the North Americans. Christ, I mean, you know, what happened over there is from Bristol here, where I'm talking to you from, John Cabot went over to, in 1497, over to North America on his little reconnaissance mission. You know, well, this is interesting. What's all this? Of course, I think probably they knew it was already there, but this was for the public's benefit, because they wanted all these migrants to go out to colonize North America, and they wanted all the slaves out there to work as you know, sort of slavery system. Kind of, in a way, it's an archetype for what we're seeing today with these central bank digital currencies. Let's have everybody as little slaves that we can switch allowed to buy, what they're not. And isn't it interesting how this comes back to talking about Debbie Hicks and Nigel Farage having their bank accounts switched off, because Farage is fronting this campaign against central bank digital currencies. Online, you'll find his adverts and things like that on YouTube and all around the internet, saying, with Nigel Farage saying, everybody must beware, this is a really dangerous development, this central bank digital currency, blah blah blah, and here's how what you can do, and you can subscribe to some newsletter or other, pay I think it's £100 a year, and get some constant updates on how to protect your wealth, because they're coming for it with the central bank digital currencies. And also it's a kind of fascistic slavery system. So he's put this out a couple of weeks ago, and all of a sudden, you know, his bank accounts are all switched off. So you don't need to be a genius to work out what's going on here. There is a faction out there, an elite faction, I would say, like the P2 in Italy in the 1980s, committees of people who just they are in charge, and they decide which politicians we're allowed to vote for. And at the end of the day, it's run by intelligence services, and the banksters mainly, but obviously the military, the top police are in there, the owners of the press, the Black Rocks, the Vanguards, the Larry Finks,
when you say it's run by representatives of the same elite families who now represent all of these entities, which are places where power resides for the time being until new technology comes, just like in the past. And one of the things that you talk about, I mean, I've got to stop there. Stop you there, because wow, I've had so many thoughts going through my mind, especially that a lot of my research that goes back to the time of when that empire was being built. It seems to be being built by necessity. So I did two separate articles about looking into family histories. One about Barbara Hewson, who was a very complicated lady who defended people like Rolf Harris and Jimmy Savile after they'd been caught. Live on on Channel 4 TV, you know, she balls out barrister, human rights barrister, and really a bit of a contrarian, from a family of contrarians, as I find out. And it's a really interesting, completely interesting that I went back into their history, back to like the, and go back through the 1400s and the 1500s in Britain. And then I went back through Bill Gates' ancestry, 700 years, and I ended up in the court of King Henry VIII, because Sir John Gates and Sir Geoffrey Gates III, Sir Geoffrey Gates III is a direct ancestor of Bill Gates, were in the court of Henry VIII. Actually, Sir John Gates walks alongside, as one of the pallbearers for Henry VIII's coffin when he died, and they become the advisors to the king, and then the next to his son Edward, and then when he dies young, and Mary takes over, they try and put Jane Seymour on the throne. And then, of course, Mary Tudor has the heads chopped off on the first day she takes office, which is, that's significant. The same people throughout history. And then the Gates family go into hiding before they run off to America. But that moment in history where you had this sudden power shift between the two, Protestant and Catholic, and you had all of those people die under Mary Tudor, I think that was really the point that put fuel within the creation of that empire, because afterwards Elizabeth put a lot of effort into colonizing as much as possible, getting out of there. And I think it was maybe a projection from her own fear that at any moment the tables could turn and they could all be on the chopping block. So they needed places to have sanctuary, and people needed to have sanctuary. And at the same time, it helped build empire and accrue massive wealth during that period. So all of the benefits were there. And when you watch how they implemented that during that period, that's really the birth of the empire. Then all of the rest afterwards, like what you're talking about in the English Civil War, that's the forming of what had already been started there. And I think that's where it came from. Personally, I think the impetus was from that really significantly scary period in history where everybody started getting burnt in the streets and having their heads chopped off and the like. Everybody, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But it's really interesting that it propels us through history like this, and we end up, like you say, in the modern day, at the time where they're changing over a banking system. And this is really significant. What you're talking about, CBDCs, there is a battle about to start. And I talked to lots of crypto people on camera and behind the scenes who know that this is a war. So is this the type of war we're going to see in the future? Is this the next stage? Is the bankers, is this the next big thing?
Well, warfare, okay, so yes, there's shooting people and bombing them in warfare, but it's also, as we talked about before, psychological warfare. So that is conning people, lying to people, convincing people, leading them around like sheep, using the wonderful invention of television and, whatever the internet, obviously, too, now. It's like the golden age of television in the 1970s and 60s and 70s mainly, where anyone could pretty much get a film onto TV, is gone or long gone. The same thing sort of seems to be happening with the internet now. So, you know, use it while you can, folks, because there's all sorts of, with the online safety bill, the idea, this is a universal thing. Look, every Western country is bringing in these controls, everyone, to make it kind of like China, you know, where you just can't have free speech anymore on the internet. There's the psychological warfare, there's the economic warfare. That was where it was very much going on in between the wars, First World War and Second World War. It really started to become a thing that the intelligence services, the Foreign Office, would have a whole kind of economic warfare department, which was run by Desmond Morton, who went on to become Winston Churchill's private secretary during the Second World War. He'd been aide-de-camp to General Haig in the First World War. So, you can just trace these specific individuals who were, I find this fascinating, who've been involved in these, you know, the development of these evil systems of lying, control, warfare, whatever. We've also got, obviously, satellite warfare, space war, that sort of thing. We've got cyber warfare now. So there's a whole different, ball game. And the Americans have rather stupidly said, well, if a cyber attack, that could be trigger a nuclear response. Really? Right? Well, and that cyber attack has come from where? From the NSA? Because they've also said, by the way, it's really impossible to tell where a cyber attack is from. So you're going to attack a country with a nuclear weapon for a cyber attack that you don't know where it's come from. I mean, this is it's not an idiotic logic. It's designed to demoralize people, and it's a kind of a signature of the despotism. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the most recent stuff I've been looking into, got triggered for me by interviewing a brilliant guy. I think he's brilliant, David Livingstone, who wrote this book, Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And he's a Canadian, and his first book was called The Dying God, and it was looking at well, it's a brilliant title because he's looking at the way that the whole concept of God has been dying, you know, or being killed off. So, you know, in medieval times, pretty much everyone believed there was a, you know, purpose to it all, you know, and we were created children of God of one sort or another. Most people thought that. But now, of course, this is so-called silly idea, you know, and he looks at that. But he also, the title, The Dying God, is also to do with this sun worship where, you know, the sun dies in the evening and is resurrected every morning. So it's a quite a clever title. And he goes into the really the dualistic challenge there's been over the millennia between the kind of Canaanite tradition and that turned into the Greek and Roman empires and all those Greek and Roman myths, as against the Judeo-Christian, biblical and Islamic tradition that's come through the Old Testament. These two kind of clashing ways of looking at the world. And, you know, and he also looks at the development of particularly of Christianity from the Orthodox, the original Orthodox Church. I mean, the Catholics love to say, oh, we're the original church, St. Peter founded it in Rome. No, no. You had a battle with the Orthodox Church in the 1100s, and or was it 10? I'm not quite sure. I think it was the 10th century, yeah, with the Orthodox Church. 1154, I think, was the Great Schism, where they each of the popes excommunicated each other in Constantinople and Rome. And so you had the split from the Orthodox Church to the Catholics, and then in the 1500s, you had the Protestants, which was a remaking of the Catholic Church to make it morally okay to screw people, if you mind my language, with business and the, for the merchants to get on and just make loads and loads of money and make everybody that you know, poor people work for them in factories and things like that. So that was another remaking of the whole faith. So I think this David, well, I was chatting to David about all this and a bit about really more to do with the transhumanism side, which is his more recent books. And I was saying to you, where has this a lot of this come from? And he mentioned this guy called Nick Land. Now, Nick Land is what he called the father of accelerationism. So this whole concept of accelerationism, where what you're doing is you're trying to move, change society, but change it faster and faster and faster. And you see all of the top people, the Schwabs, so-called top people, and the Hararis and Larry Fink, you know, the BlackRock guy. And they're all using this term all the time. And it's become a buzzword, accelerate, accelerate. We've got to accelerate this. Starmer uses it, etc. Yeah, Sunak uses it. So we've got to accelerate. So anyway, accelerationism. And he was talking about Nick Land as the father of X. Anyway, I said to us, at the end of the interview, I finished the interview with him. I said, who is this Nick Land? Who is he? Tell me a bit more about him. And he said, oh, well, he was a philosophy professor at Warwick University, went to Sussex University, studied for. And I said, hang on, I know him. I went to school with him. And so this was David in his interview says, no way, no way. So, but I did. I was friends with this guy. I used to call him Nazi Nick at school.
Oh, I was wondering what his nickname was going to be. I was guessing Nicky Knickers or something. He used to wear knickers on his head or something. But Nazi Nick. Well, that is more descriptive. And go on.
So anyway, he was a fascinating character. He really was. And he was a good mate of mine, actually, even though he was a Nazi, because he had this dark sense. He had a dark sense of humor. And he was always into doing stuff. We used to sit and play war games, you know, these tabletop war games on a Saturday around his house. His mum would bring us sandwiches and stuff. And his dad worked for Shell, by the way. He was a director of Shell in South Africa in the 1970s. That wasn't the coolest thing in the world to be. But anyway, so we'd be playing like the Six-Day War over a few hours. And then, you know, on a Saturday with a group of mates, it was called Diplomacy Club. And so we started off playing diplomacy. So this is what I did as a 13, 14-year-old kid. And then to find that he's become the father of accelerationism was a bit bizarre. And so I've been looking more and more into this. He's out in Shanghai now, which is the old opium capital, the financial capital of China. And the whole point of this is, I think, to understand what they're doing, which is, I mean, Harari, he's written this thing called The Dark Enlightenment, which is a manifesto, which is looking at the old Enlightenment from, you know, it's the Masonic thing after the Civil War. So from the 1700s, mainly, the idea of everyone can talk about religion as much as they want, and there's no kind of sanction from the church, which there used to be. You can't say this, you can't, this is blasphemy, you're going to prison, you're having your head chopped. So getting rid of that, and also opening up the whole debate around science, which was the Royal Society. So, for example, the Royal Society in Edinburgh was chaired by John Robison, or secretary was John Robison, who wrote this brilliant, amazing book, The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments, which was a look at the way that the Freemasonry that he joined, which was a speakeasy and a Christian thing, supposedly, was being taken over by these Illuminists, the Illuminati, and that that there was a satanic side to it. So John Robison is writing about this stuff. He's also mates with James Watt, who is inventing the steam engine. So that's your original Enlightenment. Now, next thing is the Dark Enlightenment. So this is all about machines controlling humans. Humans keep messing things up. We keep making a mess of things. We're not very good. Actually, of course, the fact is we're great. We're wonderful, but we keep getting manipulated and steered and messed around with by banksters, etc. So, but he wants the humanity to be enslaved by machines. He thinks that's going to be a good thing. And he wants to get rid of what he calls the cathedral, which is all these other sort of civil society things like, you know, religions, trade unions, all these things, other things that get in the way of machines controlling humanity. So he's got this. The other thing, Johnny, is that, you know, he is also very much into hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, he kind of got into that as I wasn't. You know, he kind of unfriended me when we got to about 16. But he was, the idea that somebody who's into this stuff at that early age, he was into William Gibson, all that kind of thing, should then be dropping acid on a very, very mega regular basis. He's then getting into a very, I think, dark direction. Mm-hmm. And so then he went to Warwick. He was kicked out of Warwick University, allegedly for giving LSD to his philosophy students. Mm-hmm. And also, someone was telling me, who was one of his students up there, that they were conjuring demons trying to conjure demons in the philosophy department at Warwick University. So anyway, he's ended up in China. So I just think it's, and the basics here are this dark enlightenment and accelerationism is always the same. So what they do is create a crisis. So this could be a cost of living crisis. It could be a COVID crisis. It could be a climate crisis, all sorts of crises. Oh, well, no, isn't it terrible? And they have a massive load of mass media fuss-potting about it, exaggerate it, and then the solution, which has already been pre-prepared, just makes things far worse. So this is a philosophy, I think, which is the West is in the grip of, right? It's a Nietzschean philosophy. And so the idea is that this is almost programmed into the entire civil society. And how can you do that? You might say, we live in a democracy. Rubbish. The Bilderbergers, which is another area of my study, have kind of completely got a stranglehold on policy now through their contacts in the press, in the banking sector, and particularly in politics. We've got David Lammy. God, I mean, he's about to become foreign secretary in charge of foreign policy. We saw him last month at the Bilderberg conference in Lisbon, which I always recommend people, if you can find out where it's going to be, go there, because, you know, Lammy was turning up at Bilderberg and he didn't have the right credentials to get in. So the security kept him at the gate. We had this with Ed Balls a few years ago as well. And they stood there in this embarrassing fashion. So all us photographers can kind of swarm around, get loads of pictures of embarrassed Lammy, who's, you know, he's not. I actually said under my breath, I said, hey, man, you're not important enough, you know. Anyway, so so he then went off. He didn't like having his photograph taken, and he wasn't being let in. So he went and hid behind a tree, behind a bush nearby. And he's on the phone to them. Please let me in. Can you come and send someone to let me in? And they sent somebody out. They'd already had sent somebody out, one of the security, Bilderberg security people, to say, look, and then they're going, where is he? Where's he gone? You know, he's not here anymore. He was hiding around. So Giorgio is this lovely guy who comes to most of the Bilderberg things, who's originally Italian, lives in Belgium now. He actually took the security guard around behind the bush to show where Lammy was hiding, you know.
Oh, my Lord.
And then Lammy eventually manages to get into the Bilderberg meeting. So In a nutshell, Bilderberg is the NATO lobby. It's the military-industrial complex, the evil empire, basically deciding who we can and cannot have as candidates to be, prime minister or leader of the opposition or whatever. And it's one up from the World Economic Forum, I'd say, because it's just the NATO countries. And it is a kind of parallel secret government. And that's how I think they make sure that these various policies, accelerationist policies, it's proper gender. The idea is the entire national debate is controlled. So you've got a crisis and a reaction. And all of those things are just taking away all of our... I mean, look at what's been going on with the climate stuff and net zero. I mean, the destruction of farming in Holland. And of course, if we had a left-wing government here, the same would be going on in Britain. The farmers would be being decimated, being told, you know, too many of your cows are farting, you're going to have to cut down your number of livestock, which is already very low on historic levels with all these solar panels everywhere, and they're down by 90%. And you're also not allowed to use fertilizers, or we're taxing you. Now, the Dutch farmers have got just a really simple slogan, which they've been, you know, it's brilliant to see the protests. We don't see them on the TV, of course, which is no farmers, no food. And of course, it doesn't take a genius to work out what's going on here. You know, there's a structural starvation of the population being prepared. And the land is at the back of it, like it was back in the enclosures, Johnny, and, you know, the things that led to the Civil War, is these private equity firms and the banksters are coming for the land, not just the farmland, but also your house. You know, so when you can't pay the mortgage or the council tax is jacked up so much that you can't pay that, you have to sell your house. And you might be able to still live there for a few years, but it's going to be owned by HSBC. It's going to be owned by Vanguard or Blackstone or whatever. So they're coming for the land that we need to grow our food in and to live on. And if we can't grow food and we can't live, well, we really are their slaves, aren't we?
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore, and we hope to see you live again in August next week, inshallah.
I see massive similarities between English Civil War and now, for sure, the run up to it, and the way life is, you know, the infrastructure is being manipulated by those in power. Hey, when you're talking about, did you say his name, Nick Land? Did you say Land?
Nick Land. Talking,
yeah, accelerationism. And now, a couple of things. First of all, anybody who knows me knows that I accredit psychedelics, or at least the use of psychedelics, to get to a better place. But if I had done that when I was a kid or young, I would never have got to a better place, because you have to have a really strong mind to understand what's happening and to understand what is real and what is an illusion. And psychedelics doesn't help you do that. So from a very young age, I do think there are qualities that it can bring to somebody's life.
Listen, I agree.
Yeah. But
David Nutt, who was the chief advisor on drugs to the government, has just brought out a book all about the benefits of psychedelics.
Yeah, but I
would say, you know, in one word, I would say, take a tiny bit. None of this loads and loads of psych, you know, whatever they do with ayahuasca or whatever, it's not something which is a good idea to do a lot of, you know.
I've only done that when I come to the point when I just didn't want to keep going anymore, and then I was like, there's a choice to make, and I spent 3 months making a lot of choices and looking at myself and being able to tackle issues that I could never tackle outside. But this isn't about that. One of my points about this is that the type of person that then goes and says, well, I know more because I've taken LSD, get other people to start taking LSD so they know more, and then they can usually use that to control. I've sat with people and taken it. I prefer to take those sort of things alone, because I've been with people who try to change your mind and manipulate your mind while you're on it. And he sounds like exactly that type of person. Sounds like it. Maybe he's not, but he sounds like that type of person, that Noah, Yuval Noah Harari and these guys. I've studied them, quite a bit, and I've looked at what they're doing, and it's very.
Well, look, I say stick to the natural stuff. Stick to the magic mushrooms. Have one or two or three. Yeah. You know, not 100. Like some people just think the more I have, the more amazing it's going to be, man. And also, you know, you're seeing, like, you know, whatever hallucinations you might or might not be seeing is just made up in your head. What a lot of people do is they think, well, man, I'm seeing the real reality. No. What you're seeing in a hallucination is just a dream, really. And it's a terrible, terrible mistake, which a lot of people make, is to think, well, I've seen the real world as it really is. No, it's a way of exploring yourself. Really.
It's a way of exploring yourself because it disconnects you from your...
Do it legally, and if you really have to, tiny amounts like baby steps, you know?
But it's like for me, it's like there's, it allows you to have a look at things without that judgment of yourself and the judgment of other people around. When you take something like that, you're able to detach yourself from that sense of always judging yourself. And then suddenly you're able to be more expressive. And it's true. If you, what you're saying, to microdose, is a fantastic way just to chill out and have a talk with someone and chat through your problems. A lot like, many different, drugs can do. But the point is how they use them and how other people use it, because I really mean, I've sat in a room with someone who I didn't think that I have the level of, like, sort of, I've had experience with psychedelics that I had, and tried to manipulate me. A couple of people, in actual fact, who have tried to manipulate me, and I know they're trying to manipulate me. So you know, you have to do these things with the trustworthy person.
I'm trying to manipulate you now. By saying there is a reason why it is illegal, and it's because it can destroy your mind. This is why I say, if you're going to do it in a, you know, in a very nurturing environment, and do it legally, and do it with a tiny micro doses, and don't use the chemicals.
And
use the
don't natural. Become a Nazi accelerationist. basically, that's one of the things that you also don't want to do.
There's a really good article about the death trip, right? Which is talking about Nick Land. You'll find it out there somewhere. I've tried to approach the guy. He hasn't got back to me. He wrote that, but he's saying, look, this guy is just, he's on a death trip, and he's trying to drag everyone else down with him, effectively. So, I've actually tried to get hold of Nick through a mutual friend to interview him about all this from Shanghai, but unfortunately he's not got back to me. It's just weird seeing it. I've seen talks of him, and I just remember the same intonations of the voice from sort of 13, 14 years old. But then, look, also, just to bring this stuff up to sort of really relevant today, and the struggle of people like Julian Assange, I mean, we still don't hear enough really about him on the news. And it should be all the time. All the journalists out there that don't seem to really care that too much about what happens to Julian. Of course, it's a massively important thing. And I've on this week's program got an interview with the guy that took over from Julian as the editor of WikiLeaks. Really lovely bloke, as an Icelandic investigative journalist. And we don't hear much about that, because of course most of the campaign is now to get him out off of this charge. One of the most interesting things he was telling me was that the charges against Julian may have nothing to do with the military, that if you look at the actual substance of the charges under the Espionage Act, they're talking about him releasing sensitive information to the public. Well, they didn't. They released the information to the newspapers with very clear instructions that you mustn't be printing. This is just for your information and not to be published. These names are very important. You don't publish them. So they didn't publish them. The Guardian did. The New York Times did. So the question is, what really has Julian done which has upset them more than anything else? And the answer seems to be the documents that they published during the after the 2008 banking crisis about the evidence that it was deliberate, and that the bankers have been doing it deliberately. Well, WikiLeaks published a whole load of that stuff, and in fact, several bankers around the world were jailed as a result. Quite long sentences, 5, 6, 7 years in prison for what WikiLeaks released.
A load of other bankers who were involved in that are now World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders from the past couple of years, only the past couple of years.
And the other thing I must say is, you know, I'm a Christian, that is to say, I was brought up sort of Church of England, you know, going to a local church. But then I realized kind of that there was something missing in the Church of England. Eventually came around to become a Quaker. But the point is that this Christian tradition is really important as a moral kind of anchor to sort of. And also, I believe historically, absolutely, you know, the history of the Jews is an absolutely brilliant, amazing tale, but it's true. I think that's what did happen. You know, Moses did come out of the slavery of Pharaoh in Egypt, and they did set off to that part of the world, and God did sort that place out for them, you know, and looked after these people. I mean, the Jewish religion, race, whatever you want to call it, they are an amazing bunch of people. I mean, they can be flawed and they can be bad and good just like anyone else, but I've over the years learned a tremendous amount of wisdom from people brought up in the Jewish tradition. Obviously what's going on over in Palestine is hideous, disgusting. It's a kind of hijacking of that faith. Completely. And isn't it handy how the rabbinic tradition in Europe, which would now be opposing what's going on in Palestine, it was massacred by Hitler. So that rabbinic tradition, the sort of ordinary normal Jews from right over Europe, were just put into the mincing machine. And so there's been this Zionist kind of fake version of the religion has been created, the same as the, you know, your Al-Qaeda's a fake version of Islam, and the same as the Christian Zionist nutters are the fake version of the Christianity. Mm-hmm. So these various faiths have been occupied, and all you see on television is that, oh, the nutty Christian, you know, vicar's a pervert, and, you know, so it's perfect to give the faith a really bad press. I've finished up by saying, by my little religious rant, if you want, is look at the book of Revelation. My God, this stuff is all happening. You know, the mark of the beast, for God's sake, is happening. You know, the idea of the image of the beast, which is this animated statue, robotics, is all happening right now. And, you know, it's difficult to know, to piece it all together, but you can see for sure, if someone comes along to you and says, hey, we're going to put a microchip in your hand just there, or maybe we'll put one in your forehead, you know, and if you're one of the really super elite, you can have it there, and it'll make your transactions so much easier. And this is obviously written by John. Actually, it was Procurus, who was his little scribe, the Apostle John, on Patmos, about 90 AD. And there was all sorts of battles over the centuries to keep it in and out of the Bible. But I think, you know, now is the time to dust off your Bible, have a look at that book of Revelation, see what it's saying, because it's speaking to us, I think, very much. The idea of the four horsemen of the apocalypse as well is really important, because this is a signal. It's saying, look, you know, this is going to get really, really rough, but keep your faith. And the idea of the four horsemen is, look, when these events start happening, I'm not going to say what they are. I think they're to do with a war, they're to do with a famine, and they're also to do with economic collapse. I think the black horse is economic collapse, and the pale horse is disease and famine, killing loads of people. But these four horsemen of the apocalypse is God saying, look, guys, you know, it's going to get rough, but keep the faith. Don't worry, because, well, you know, you obviously might well be worried when you're on death's door, or there's a war's going on and the sky goes dark or whatever. And the other thing is read The Lord of the Rings. The Lord of the Rings is a fantastic allegory for all of this. And Tolkien was weaving in a lot of the imagery that we look around. I mean, the Illuminati imagery with the Eye of Sauron. You've got the traitor Saruman, which is the Freemason, the white hand of the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. And so he's weaving in all of that, you know, the treacherous people we have around us, maybe even within our own family. Certainly, mm-hmm. you know, in our civic society, there are traitors out there who are selling us out. They want us dead. They want us out of the way. So this is all in there for that sort of final battle, which, of course, the good people win, ultimately. Yeah. Now, quite how it all transpires, I don't know. We may not be alive to see it. We probably won't. But the fact is that it's not just about, you know, the goodness of humanity will prevail. There is a plan unfolding. And the bad guys, well, you know, what's happened is they're at war with Russia right now, and they're also at war with their own people. So they're isolating themselves slowly but surely. They're becoming less and less and less people that will actually do these evil deeds and enslave humanity, that have the arrogance to think that they are gods. You know, oh, God is just a load of silly rubbish and nonsense. I'm a god. I can do what I want. Look, you know, look, I can make all these people kill themselves with COVID vaccines. Ha ha, aren't I clever? You know, so this is their attitude. They like the idea of being able to sort of con people into their own demise. And so I think that's what we're up against in this kind of spiritual war, Johnny. And I see it, you know, in the pages of Revelation sort of opening up bit by bit. These bits and pieces in that book are being put into place. It talks about locusts, you know, locust-like things.
I tell the people out there, if you want an amazing telling of Revelations, you should be listening to Vangelis and Demi Russo, an Aphrodite's Child, 666, Mark of the Beast, that tells double album that tells of everything, including the plague of the locust, and that is one hell of a bit of progressive rock.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think we're talking here, because if they'd have seen a drone, you know, in a vision back in 90 AD, that was, well, it's like that, isn't it? I don't know what it is, but it's a bit like a locust.
That is a fantastic. I'd love to go into this in much more detail on another time, because that is exactly placed on a note of the post-World War, when they created the CIA, the majority of the people who formed the CIA, including Kermit Roosevelt and others, were really strong anti-Zionists. They believed the idea of creation of the state of Israel and under the banner of Zionism by these Zionist actors was a really bad idea for the future. And they fought really hard against it up until they were defeated around 1966, 1967. And eventually the tide turned against them, and then after that everybody was on board, or most of the powerful were on board and knew they had to be on board by that point. The tide had turned. So there's a history that I think always surprises people when you tell people about that. I've seen people who are really angry about Israel and Zionism who don't know that part of history. They think that America has been on board the entire time and everybody's been on board, but
okay, here's a little tale which was revealed in the Silurian blog in the Daily Telegraph must be 15 years ago now, which was that Jim Morrison, the Doors singer's father, he was an admiral in the Sixth Fleet, which is the Mediterranean fleet for the US, and that was involved in the Six-Day War. And
another event.
USS Liberty was in the Sixth Fleet, and of course the admiral of the fleet, with his sitting in his aircraft carrier or wherever he was, is saying, hang on, the Israelis have just attacked one of my boats and tried to sink it, let's do a raid on the Israeli air bases. And this is in the height of the Six-Day War. So the planes, the aircraft were actually scrambled, the Phantom jets from the aircraft carriers, and were heading off to bomb the Israelis when Lyndon Johnson called him up and said, bring the planes back, we're not retaliating, we're not going to fight the Israelis. So that was a quite an important moment where, you know, the powers that be, obviously Johnson was involved in the assassination of JFK, was very, very much involved in it, as Edgar Hoover was, and the Texas barons hiring the Chicago mob, including the rather accurate.
I'd love to go into that as well, because I mean, I talked with Corey Hughes about that, and I always find that Lyndon B. Johnson looks like he was in complete shell shocked when it happened. I think they kept him at a certain distance here and there, but he knew certain parts of it, and it all, he didn't know it was going to be then and there and quite.
But it's Marion, I think, and his girlfriend's name is Marion, and I'm not sure if she was Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend or Edgar Hoover's. It was in a brilliant ITV documentary about who killed JFK from the 1980s. And she just says, it's in my book, by the way. It's all the, I transcribed it all. That is to say, the Siege of Heaven Reader. And it's where she describes being at H.R. Hunt, I think his name is, house, the night before the assassination. Lyndon Johnson saying to her, the Kennedy brothers will never bother me again. They'd had a big meeting there with Hoover and the rest of them, and they hired James Files and Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli from the Chicago Mafia, three hitmen, to come down and to kill JFK. And this was mainly because of the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. There were a lot of people who had been training for the Bay of Pigs and the takeover of Cuba, and Kennedy refused to include the US Air Force to do cover for their invasion. And so a lot of them died. It was all humiliating, and they hated Kennedy for that main reason. But this was really just an excuse to take out. And isn't it interesting how his nephew is, it was his father was killed afterwards, RFK. What is it, about 8 years afterwards, was assassinated because he wanted to open up the reopen the inquiry into JFK's killing. And now his son is in the running for the Democratic nomination. So this is a fascinating thing. It's a complete news blackout on this, by the way, even though it's such a fascinating story.
Completely. Completely interesting. I think it was about 5 years. I think it was 68 that RFK. I only know that because I just looked into it recently. Listen, thank you for all your time. We've got so much to talk about in the future, and we're on the same wavelength now. I'm glad I caught up with you. It's taken me a bit of a while, but I've got a lot of reading to do, so I'm gonna go and look into your work and your books and really start trying to take in what's going on. So
I've got another that book I was telling you about, The Siege of Heaven Reader, is a sort of
you're classed as editor.
It's an anthology, so which I edited, which is all the way from the English Civil War to the assassination of Diana. And there's a lot about, you know, why Charles was involved in that, and, you know, why she was in the way, why she was so problematic, why she had to be murdered. Well, of course it is. You know, do we want a wife murderer as king? I mean, that's a question that I think should be...
The people in power do.
So there's that, you know, and it also shows, doesn't it, how... the evildoers are really getting smaller and smaller in number and having to kind of stay together in their cults, because they realize any kind of outsiders might just betray them or might not be reliable. It's a control freak. It's the same as the fall of Rome. This is what happened with Rome. So there's that, the Siege of Heaven Reader. That's £20, but it's an easy thing to dip into. Loads and loads of stuff about hidden government, secret government through history, from the English Civil War up to the and then I did an investigation into the Bilderbergers and Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's private secretary, because I came across some individuals who'd been involved in World War II who were responsible for getting Martin Bormann out of Berlin just before, literally the few days before the end of the Second World War, by canoe. And it was commandos trained down in Hayling Island, plus some Jewish commandos. And of course, the thing, Bormann, he as a person had to be brought out, because he was a signatory to all the major Nazi bank accounts. So around about $1 billion, which in 1945 was a lot more than a billion now, in Switzerland, Argentina, etc. And he was responsible for the whole sort of plan to recreate the Third Reich, you know, industrial, economic Fourth Reich after the war. But so he had a lot of money, and so he was doing deals all around the world with the Brits at the end of the war. So this is really looking at how that ended up with the same people involved in the Battle of Arnhem, which provided the extra time Bormann needed to secrete the Nazi wealth around the world and get his plans all ready to go. That they were the ones that were chosen, the ones that threw the fight in Arnhem to do things like chair the Bilderberg conferences for 20 years, as Prince Bernhard did. Peter Carrington, he also became a chairman of the Bilderberg meeting before he died. He was in charge of he was a defense secretary when we had Bloody Sunday, for example, and the parachute regiment massacring people. So these individuals can be very much directly connected back to this battle in World War II, and also to the recreation of the Nazis as an industrial empire and a massive bunch of cartels, where the clever thing they did, I mean, there's two books, really, that I got most of the information, plus a few individuals that came to me with extra information. One is called Op JB by Christopher Crichton, which looks at the escape of Bormann to London eventually and out of Berlin at the end of the war. And then the second one is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, written by CBS journalist Paul Manning. And Paul wrote this in the 1980s, but he had discovered Bormann over in South America, creating all these businesses, laundering the cash from the loot of the war through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, into these new companies. And the clever thing they did was many of the companies were fronted by Jews. So there'd be a Jew as a chairman. So no one would ever suspect that company was actually financed from the Nazi loot of World War II. Very, very smart, you know. So it's called The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. So it's looking at the creation of the links between the Bilderbergers and the creation of this Fourth Reich. And the final one is just an ebook, and that is just it's called The Siege of Heaven, which is a look at a bunch of my articles I did for RT, and some that RT wouldn't use, and others that I've written since. So I've done one on the cost of living crisis, which is looking at housing and the way that the price of housing is being used to force the cost of living crisis in, and even the Labour Party is trying to take people's houses off them, you know. So and then the other one is to look at the English Civil War and the witchcraft and the run up to the English Civil War, and the way that the Protestant Reformation, because the Catholics had been really hopeless in prosecuting witchcraft cases, and so the Protestants all started getting involved. You know, right, we know there's some witches, we're going to prosecute them. And it's the way that the witchcraft system was used by Cromwell to organise the conspiracy to do a judicial kind of assassination, a bit like they're trying to do to Trump, you know. And, the character assassination of Boris and all these. I mean, this is becoming a normal thing now in Brazil, et cetera. Lula and Dilma Rousseff before him have been, you know, as soon as Bolsonaro's just come out of power, no, they're going to put him on trial, you know. So attempt to control, to make sure that anybody that looks like they might be a decent leader is put on trial and taken through the courts and stopped from even standing. That sort of thing was going on way back in the English Civil War as well. So that's called The Siege of Heaven, but it's just an ebook. My weekly, I mean, Bilderberg.org has been there for a long time, just hanging around with
background. It is one hell of a hulk of a load of information in there, I tell you.
I mean, a lot of that I got from the Bodleian Library when I was living in Oxford in the 1990s, and just literally scanned in and put it up online, because it's all background on who the Bilderbergers were. I mean, it just got my goat that you've got the chairman of the Bilderberg for the first 20 years is a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Like, you know, no one's supposed to bat an eyelid. And then I do a weekly radio show, which is we were booted off even of silly little community radio here in Bristol on FM. But I mean, that was during COVID, because we've been covering Andrew Wakefield and, all the questions about MMR vaccines and...
you can't do that, Tony.
This is it. The Bristol Mafia didn't... I mean, I'm also criticising our mayor here, who's a Yale World Fellow, Marvin East, and in his dad was involved very much in the underground and in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. In fact, in a court case where he was accused of trying to murder the leader of the anti-apartheid group in Bristol. So, I mean, he's a black guy. So, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why the Bristol establishment don't like me. I've been also involved in exposing the Merchant Venturers, who are this organisation set up by the discoverer. Yeah, they were set up after the discovery of North America to exploit it, and they were involved. But they're still there. The Hewsons
were involved in a Yorkshire version of it that was like, it's amazing. I've done research on that before. It's a really interesting moment. It's that moment of we're going to take over the world.
Well, the thing is that they are a sort of local Illuminati. You know, who the hell are these people? There's 120 of them apparently. apparently. Their accounts are not visible to journalists because it's all under a royal charter. Only the Privy Council can scrutinise their accounts. Wow. You know, so and if you look at, it's very difficult to understand exactly what they're about. But what one thing you can always do is their shareholdings will allow them to nominate people onto boards of companies. So you can see there where their shares are because they're putting their people, who's another merchant venturer, onto this company. Mm-hmm. In fact, sometimes they do that before they've even become. So there's this whole group of businesses in Bristol, wow, of people that want to join the merchant venturers so their kids will never have to work and they can spend their whole life playing golf if they want, you know, because the shares that they own, Johnny, are, you can see it's things like the water company, you know, the electricity company, the gas, all the stuff that Thatcher privatized. They bought all the shares up, and every time you turn on a light bulb or you switch the tap on, the money is going to them.
They're hitting another golf ball into the bunker. That's it.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, so that's thisweek.org.uk. You can catch the show, and there's also an app which Nick, lovely Nick from Poland, well, he's a Brit who lives in Poland.
Not Nazi creation. Nick, a different Nick.
No, definitely a different Nick. Yeah, completely opposite. Yeah. And it's called Not the BCFM Politics Show app. I know it's quite a mouthful. Not the BCFM Politics Show. Stick that on your phone and it will ping you about 15 minutes before the show starts on a Friday. So you can listen live or you can download the show afterwards on the app, or you can listen to, because I have longer clips. And if you found a little clip I've used, a short clip, interesting, you can go and listen to the full interview on the app, or you can just download it off the website thisweek.org.uk, Johnny.
Awesome. Excellent. Listen, that's a load of information. I'm sure a load of people in my audience, they're already going to know you. But I'm sure every time they listen to you, they learn a load of new information. And thanks for giving me your time. I know you're a bit busy. So I really appreciate it. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, so it's great that there's people like you and I helping people navigate the minefield, because there's loads and loads and loads of really sophisticated rubbish out there. Mm. And so that's what we try and do every week, is help people through it.
Well, it's appreciated, and thanks for talking to me today.
Okay, Johnny, take care.
The capabilities of most weapons are pretty well understood, but when it comes to atomic explosions, the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Needs test able. A submarine bomb exploded in a harbor might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly, a pass-through quickly, with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. Their beam blunted one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you'd insist, would be symptomatic. A toupee. And the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back. Same color. So we have to cover up in our own way. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. Duck and cover. Atta boy, Tony. That flash means act fast. Shelves to crawl into like Bertha Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb, duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. Duck and cover. Atta boy, Tony. That flash means act fast.
seems to be the trouble, soldier. You look a little bit worried.
Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit.
Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here. Sir, have you ever been out of one of these shops before?
Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men.
What's it like, Chaplain?
First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven.
It's a wonderful sight to behold.
atomic explosions, the guessing game starts.
All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Meet Ted Dable.
A submarine bomb exploded in a hangar might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly or passed through quickly with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. They're being right at one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you insist, would be symptomatic, a toupee. But the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back, same color, same height.
Much about the atom bomb if it were to kill you right out. What scares me is that awful gas that deforms you.
Yeah. That would be bad.
Yeah.
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore, and we hope to see you live again in August next week, inshallah.
Now that Pope Francis has completed his mission to the United States, it is time for a little bit of reflection as to what happened during that visit. When we discussed what was going to happen, I think we summed up more or less what he was going to do. There was one or two surprises, but generally speaking, it was a masterpiece of media and social performance. When Pope Francis arrived in his airplane and it landed, and he was greeted by the President and the Vice President of the United States of America and his family, there was a reception such as had never been afforded any foreign dignity in the history of the United States.
And I'll tell you, as the plane pulled up, I watched the crowd here lean up against the fences that are around the grandstands here, every one of them pushing forward with a phone or a camera in their hands to capture this moment. You're watching now, as you can see, that red carpet about to roll out. And it was interesting, about an hour ago, we saw them roll out the red carpet, and we thought, oh, they've rolled out the red carpet. That was just a practice run. They have practiced everything to a T here, including that perfectly lined up honor guard you're seeing there as well. They want to get this right. It's a special moment. It's a historic moment. We got a remarkable seat here. So I have to tell you, Jake, and I've seen official visits before, I haven't seen one quite like this.
The aircraft with which he landed and all subsequent aircraft received the code Shepherd 1. And then the symbolic meaning of his visit. The pomp and ceremony surrounding his visit alone speaks of the high esteem in which the world holds this pontiff.
It's an extraordinary moment. First of all, the joy is palpable, not only here. The joy in Philadelphia as we're talking here, as we're waiting here. There's 17,000 delegates to the world meeting of families watching this great event in Philadelphia. The people of New York, very, very happy that he's coming. What's happening here is for the whole world. The world is watching this particular visit. For me personally, the Holy Father is the vicar of Christ. He's our leader. He's our shepherd. And when you know the shepherd, it makes an even bigger difference.
One of his first acts on his American tour was the canonization of the Spanish saint, Junipero Serra. Now this in itself speaks books, volumes of what was the agenda of the papacy.
Y hoy recordamos a uno de esos testigos que supo testimoniar en estas tierras la alegría del Evangelio, Fray Junipero Serra.
This Spanish saint was part of the Spanish Californian mission, and he was at one stage an inquisitor. He was part of the Inquisition, and he ruled with ruthlessness. There was much controversy surrounding this man, seeing that some of the Native Americans were highly upset and accused him even of genocidal activity. The Pope used this canonization to reflect on the Catholic mission in the United States. And coupled with this mission, of course, you have the issue of immigration, which played a major part in his tour. The reception of the immigrant. He referred to himself as an American, saying that the boundaries really were irrelevant, and that the borders should be open for those of the southern states to enter in. Now, why was America founded in the first place? America was founded because the Puritans and the Christians in Europe fled the tyranny of papal persecution. They fled to this land which opened its arms to receive them. And they wanted a land that was free from the tyranny of persecution on religious grounds. So here was a Protestant nation. And today there's this great controversy about the borders and how to contain the immigration into this nation. And the Pope turned it around. He would like to see those borders open, because then the nation would be flooded with Catholicism. Protestantism would be obliterated and pushed into the background. Now, to canonize this person, Junipero Serra, as a saint, was a very strange act indeed, particularly looking at the history of this man. Coming with the Spaniards into California, creating missions, using the Indians basically as slave labor, and he was a person that used self-flagellation, which was common in the Middle Ages. Martin Luther, when he was still a Roman Catholic, did that because somehow he had to do penance for his sins. But Junipero took it to extremes. He wore garments that were spiked with wires and with boar hairs to create constant pain to himself. He flagellated himself to the point of total collapse. And this is the attribute which is called saintly. It is a total denial of the vicarious death of Jesus Christ, who became sin for me, who took upon himself my sinful so that he paid the price for it. In him I am free. I have no need for the works of self-flagellation. This was an act of open controversy, denying the very Protestant principles on which the United States were based. Consequently, after this canonization, it's interesting that it was probably, so they believe, Native Americans actually defaced the statues of Junipero Serra in an act of defiance, throwing paint upon them and writing words of a derogatory nature over the tombstones, etc. So not everybody was well pleased with this first gesture of the Pope. When he was greeted at the White House, it was the most illustrious ceremony ever afforded a foreign dignitary. He was referred to as the example of humility to mankind. And in his speech, he also referred to the immigrant issue and that everybody was at one stage an immigrant and that the doors should be opened, that America should be one. So this theme was very recurring in his speeches. The most interesting one was, of course, the Capitol. Now, the Capitol, as we discussed previously, is a fascinating building, and it actually refers back to ancient Rome, the Capitol, which is a Roman idea, and it is basically a copy of St. Peter's. It is a temple. So in a sense, the shepherd one was entering into the temple.
Mr. Speaker, the Pope of the Holy See.
And there he stood and gave his speech between the fasciae. The two great fasciae in this wonderful arena. And what did the fasciae actually refer to? These bundles of rods tied together. This was what the Romans used when the Roman leader would take the nations and the clans and bind them to himself with cords. And the one strong man in the middle became the norm of unity for all of them. This was the man of the moment, stepping in between the fasciae. He immediately pointed across the hall to the relief of Moses, and he spoke about the law. Now, it's interesting that this relief of Moses is surrounded by a laurel wreath. Now, a laurel wreath is distinctly Roman. But of course, it's not only the centerpiece of Moses that is displayed there in the Capitol, but on the sides are the reliefs of other great dignitaries of the past that were associated with the law. And it's fascinating that Hammurabi, for example, is there displayed, also with the laurel wreath. And Hammurabi's law was a very harsh law, totally contrary to the law of God. Then you had Pope Innocent, for example, as one of the great examples of law-giving. So this is a total Catholic setting, a very Roman setting indeed. You know, when we think back over history, and you think of Herod's temple, for example. Herod constructed this second temple, and it wasn't nearly as spectacular as the first temple, but he dedicated that temple not to the God of Israel, but he had a Roman eagle placed at the entrance, in a sense dedicating it to Rome. And the Jewish zealots were very, very upset, and some of them went and defaced that Roman eagle, and Herod had them hunted down and tortured to death. You cannot take the things of God and dedicate them to a pagan system. That is syncretism. Syncretism is something that God has constantly warned against in his Bible. You cannot worship God by the means of Baal. You cannot take God's law and package it in Roman law. So this statue, or this relief rather, of Moses that the Pope referred to.
Yours is a walk which makes me reflect in two ways on the figure of Moses.
When you look at it there embodied in its Roman system, it actually tells us literally that this law of Moses is packaged in the legal system of Rome. And if we understand that Rome changed the law of God and gave its own flavor to the law of God, then this becomes even more apparent. And here was the first citizen of the world, the re-embodiment of Osiris, the great god, because as we mentioned before, the Pope had seated himself just prior to this event on the great white throne between the cherubim, showing that he is God. And his morality was to become the morality of the world. He referred to climate change. And of course he was rather clever. He used the great historic figures of the United States to bring across his points. He used Abraham Lincoln to argue against any form of polarization. He used Thomas Merton to argue that there should be peace amongst religions and that any form of fundamentalism is a danger to faith and that no religion is immune from fundamentalism. Fundamentalism was a major portion of this way of thinking. And what is fundamentalism? According to the dictionary, fundamentalism is a form of Protestantism that takes the Bible literally, that believes in a literal creation, that believes in a resurrection, that believes in a virgin birth, that believes in the second coming. In other words, if you take your Bible literally, then you are a fundamentalist. And according to the Vatican, fundamentalism is a major problem in the world today and needs to be curtailed. Dorothy Day was the great example of social justice. All the Catholic doctrines espoused in the individuals that he mentioned. Martin Luther King, the foreigner, the disenfranchised, how to accept them. It was brilliantly done and very convincing. But the deep undertones of Catholic social justice were very, very apparent. And if we understand Roman Catholic social justice, then we will know that it is based not on the capitalistic idea of social justice, but on the Thomas Aquinas idea that basically you possess nothing and Rome is the one that determines the distribution and the equity of all goods and property. The Roman Catholic view on the right to life and abortion, these were all issues that were highlighted by the Pope. It's interesting that some of the members of the House of the Republican Party had actually boycotted this meeting. It's fascinating to me what the Jesuit commentator on CNN had to say about it, because the people who boycotted it, or the person who boycotted it, was actually Jesuit trained. And when this was pointed out, the Jesuit on CNN said, well, Jesuits are known to be on both sides of the question, part of the Hegelian dialectic. It's interesting, when I look at the undercurrent and the subliminal messages that were in this trip, then they speak actually more than the words that were actually spoken. Isn't it interesting that he should highlight the immigration question while some of the Republican candidates were speaking so strongly against it, about borders and walls and gates. He was opening up the world. Here was this new global village where everybody felt welcome and everybody was one. One wonders whether some of the pre-speeches were choreographed in order to emphasize the contrast to Pope Francis. Some of the other subliminal little issues that I find interesting is the way in which he traveled, which the media picked up as humility. For example, he traveled in his little Fiat next to these great Suburbans that were driving in front and behind him. And they pointed this out frequently as a sign of humility. But these vehicles were chosen very carefully, and they were chosen by the Vatican itself. The news tells us that the vehicles were chosen by the Vatican. Now, the word fiat, of course, has an interesting connotation. To rule by fiat means to have absolute authority. So driving in the fiat means absolute authority. For example, the dictionary would say, the headmaster made a fiat decree that such and such was to be the case, and that was that. So fiat, ruling with absolute authority. The other vehicle chosen by the Pope and the Vatican, well in advance to this meeting, was of course the Pope Mobile, which was a Jeep Wrangler. Now, this name in itself is fascinating. A Wrangler is of course someone who controls the herds. And Jeep also is interesting because it comes from Eugene the Jeep, which is the creature that we find in the Popeye cartoons. But this was a very interesting creature because he was a mythological creature almost. He could transmigrate between the dimensions, and he had a solution to every problem. So he was a being of a higher norm and a higher fashion. This creature, if he could transcend the dimensions, is like an angelic being. Isn't that interesting that the year 2015 was declared by the United Nations as the Year of Light? And they dedicated to, of course, technology and light technology. But to declare this year the Year of Light, it reminds me of the French foreign minister who spoke about the 500 days to the prevention of the climate catastrophe and the descending into the abyss. And the 500 days culminated exactly with this papal visit. And here you have the United Nations declaring this year, 2015, as the Year of Light. Now, the Latin for that is Anno Lucis. And this is used in Freemasonry. Freemasonry dates all its events by Anno Lucis, the Year of Light. And if you look at Masonic cornerstones, for example, or commemorative stones, then you will find the date of the present, let's say the year 2015, and you will find it in Anno Lucis, where they add 4,000 years to this period. And this is also the year in which the Pope spoke at the United Nations. Now, previous popes had also spoken at the United Nations, but this was different to any other previous pope, because this was also the 70th year of the commemoration of the founding of the United Nations, and it is the first time in history that a pope spoke to all the assembled world leaders. All previous popes had merely spoken to the ambassadors of the various states. But here, all the world leaders were present. And his message was of particular importance for this time, of course, steeped in the issue of climate change. He spoke about human rights. dispelling the collective forms of human selfishness. He spoke about equity. He spoke about access, distribution, equitable distribution, fairness, all these great words. He referred to his predecessors who had also spoken about these issues. And this reminds me of Pope Benedict's speech when he touted human rights as God-given. And he referred to Benedict and his speech in terms of human rights. And Benedict had also made it quite clear that human rights were based on natural law. So it's not based on divine law. And natural law is, of course, the basis upon which Roman Catholicism bases its authority. And why it claims that it can change the law of God, because it doesn't base it on scripture, but on natural law. And who is the one who exemplifies natural law? The Pope himself, because from his elevated position of observation, according to Benedict, he is the one who surveys the landscape and decides what is morally right and what is morally wrong. And if you take this together with Ban Ki-moon's statements that the moral stature of the Pope was not to be denied, then this all comes together. Of course, he referred to the law being inscribed in the heart, and he brought this into connection with the environment, referring, of course, also to the November meeting in Paris, where legislation will have to be put in place. Now, during his visit, he didn't mention Sunday legislation in particular, but prior to his visit, he did state that Sunday is to be the heart of the new dispensation. And in his encyclical on the environment, he also elevated Sunday. And if we look at some of the news media's reports on this summit in Paris, then it becomes obvious that this will also be a point of question. Just a few months earlier, The Guardian, for example, had said, if we should set Sunday aside as a day of rest, it would contribute greatly to fighting climate change, because then industry would come to rest at least one day in the week and contribute greatly to a lowering of the carbon damage to our planet. So all of these issues were embodied in these speeches. He made a great moral appeal for working together, for accepting the responsibility for the state of the planet, ridding the world of the fear of nuclear war. All of these issues were, of course, endearing, and he received standing ovations at all his speeches, whether it was at the Capitol or at the United Nations.
Apologies, no live show again this week due to family reasons, but what we do have is this mind-blowing investigation by Eric John Phelps and Walter Veith into the idea that Islam is a man-made religion made in the Vatican. Plus, we also have my recent complete interview with Johnny Vedmore, and we hope to see you live again in August next week, inshallah.
And to avert the most serious effects of the environmental deterioration caused by human activity, I'm convinced that we can make a difference. I'm sure. And
what is very interesting is that the subsequent speeches by the world leaders were almost more fascinating than the speeches by Francis himself. President Obama came across at the United Nations as the father of the human family, as the one who wanted to create this equity and this fairness. He referred to Russia and its role, and that no nation was to interfere with the sovereignty or the territory of another nation. He referred to the Iran deal as creating peace, that he had no intention of taking someone's territory or having any economic interests whatsoever, but that the United States was there to ensure this fairness and this democracy and this equity. He was like a father figure, a brilliant speech. But he referred to Pope Francis, and he also spoke about religious extremism, that it should be curtailed at all costs. Obama, after castigating religious sectarianism, said they needed a stronger United Nations, and he referred to the 50 nations that would come together to create a greater military capacity in the United Nations to oversee peacekeeping missions in the world, with many, many boots on the ground, a strong military component to the United Nations. So here was one speaking as the leader of the human family. King Abdullah of Jordan also made some very interesting statements. He said, religious extremism must not have access to the media in any form. And he said the war is between religious moderates and extremists of all faiths. Basically, he was referring to hate speech and creating religious turmoil in the world. A very strong speech indeed. Religious polarization has to be curtailed. And as Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit, who was the father, as it were, of the philosophy of the United Nations, had said, the only way forward is all together. And we need to focus on a Messiah that satisfies them all. So an extreme view would be, of course, to say that Jesus is the only way to salvation. That would be an extreme view that would exclude other religious sects and other religious systems. If you want to stick to the faith that there is salvation in no other name than that of Jesus Christ, then you will be branded as a fundamentalist. I believe the world is moving in that direction. And I'd be interested to know what kind of legislation will come out of the Paris meeting, when all the nations will have to commit to certain issues. But whether it happens there or whether it happens later is irrelevant. I believe we are on a course that cannot be reversed any longer, where there will be a confrontation between those that say, all together, and those that say, come out and be separate, says the Lord, and I will receive you. Either Jesus is the only way to salvation on this planet, or he is not. And every single individual on this planet will have to make a choice. Either I accept the morality and the law of God as the standard of righteousness, or I accept the law as modulated by Rome and changed by Rome as the standard. As for me and my household, we have decided we will serve the Lord. One of his first acts on his American tour was the canonization of the Spanish saint, Junipero Serra. Now this in itself speaks books, volumes, of what was the agenda of the papacy.
Yo recordamos a uno de esos testigos que supo testimoniar en estas tierras la alegría del Evangelio, Fray Junipero Serra.
This Spanish saint was part of the Spanish Californian mission, and he was at one stage an inquisitor He was part of the Inquisition. And he ruled with ruthlessness. There was much controversy surrounding this man, seeing that some of the Native Americans were highly upset and accused him even of genocidal activity. The Pope used this canonization to reflect on the Catholic mission in the United States. And coupled with this mission, of course, you have the issue of immigration, which played a major part in his tour, the reception of the immigrant. He referred to himself as an American, saying that the boundaries really were irrelevant, and that the boundaries should be, the borders should be open for those of the southern states to enter in. Now, why was America founded in the first place? America was founded because the Puritans and the Christians in Europe fled the tyranny of papal persecution. They fled to this land which opened its arms to receive them. And they wanted a land that was free from the tyranny of persecution on religious grounds. So here was a Protestant nation. And today there's this great controversy about the borders and how to contain the immigration into this nation. And the Pope turned it around. He would like to see those borders open, because then the nation would be flooded with Catholicism. Protestantism would be obliterated and pushed into the background. Now, to canonize this person, Junipero Serra, as a saint, was a very strange act indeed, particularly looking at the history of this man. Coming with the Spaniards into California, creating missions, using the Indians basically as slave labor, and he was a person that used self-flagellation, which was common in the Middle Ages, Martin Luther, when he was still a Roman Catholic.
Makes me reflect in two ways on the figure of Moses.
When you look at it there embodied in its Roman system, it actually tells us literally that this law of Moses is packaged in the legal system of Rome. And if we understand that Rome changed the law of God and gave its own flavor to the law of God, then this becomes even more apparent. And here was the first citizen of the world, the re-embodiment of Osiris, the great god, because as we mentioned before, the Pope had seated himself just prior to this event on the great white throne between the cherubim, showing that he is God. And his morality was to become the morality of the world. He referred to climate change. And of course he was rather clever. He used the great historic figures of the United States to bring across his points. He used Abraham Lincoln to argue against any form of polarization. He used Thomas Merton to argue that there should be peace amongst religions and that any form of fundamentalism is a danger to faith, and that no religion is immune from fundamentalism. Fundamentalism was a major portion of this way of thinking. And what is fundamentalism? According to the dictionary, fundamentalism is a form of Protestantism that takes the Bible literally, that believes in a literal creation, that believes in a resurrection, that believes in a virgin birth, that believes in the second coming. In other words, if you take your Bible literally, then you are a fundamentalist. And according to the Vatican, fundamentalism is a major problem in the world today and needs to be curtailed. Dorothy Day was the great example of social justice. All the Catholic doctrines espoused in the individuals that he mentioned: Martin Luther King, the foreigner, the disenfranchised, how to accept them. It was brilliantly done. and very convincing, but the deep undertones of Catholic social justice were very, very apparent. And if we understand Roman Catholic social justice, then we will know that it is based not on the capitalistic idea of social justice, but on the Thomas Aquinas idea that basically you possess nothing and Rome is the one that determines the And there he stood and gave his speech between the fasciae, the two great fasciae in this wonderful arena. And what did the fasciae actually refer to? These bundles of rods tied together. This was what the Romans used when the Roman leader would take the nations and the clans and bind them to himself with cords, and the one strong man in the middle became the norm of unity for all of them. This was the man of the moment stepping in between the fasciae. He immediately pointed across the hall to the relief of Moses, and he spoke about the law. Now, it's interesting that this relief of Moses is surrounded by a laurel wreath. Now, a laurel wreath is distinctly Roman. But of course, it's not only the centerpiece of Moses that is displayed there in the Capitol, but on the sides are the reliefs of other great dignitaries of the past that were associated with the law. And it's fascinating that Hammurabi, for example, is there displayed also with the laurel wreath. And Hammurabi's law was a very harsh law, totally contrary to the law of God. Then you had Pope Innocent, for example, as one of the great examples of lawgiving. So this is a total Catholic setting, a very Roman setting indeed. You know, when we think back over history, and you think of Herod's temple, for example, Herod constructed this second temple, and it wasn't nearly as spectacular as the first temple, but he dedicated that temple not to the God of Israel, but he had a Roman eagle placed at the entrance, in a sense dedicating it to Rome. And the Jewish zealots were very, very upset, and some of them went and defaced that Roman eagle, and Herod had them hunted down and tortured to death. You cannot take the things of God and dedicate them to a pagan system. That is syncretism. Syncretism is something that God has constantly warned against in his Bible. You cannot worship God by the means of Baal. You cannot take God's law and package it in Roman law. So this statue, or this relief rather, of Moses that the Pope referred to,
yours is a walk, which
did that because somehow he had to do penance for his sins. But Junipero took it to extremes. He wore garments that were spiked with wires and with boar hairs to create constant pain to himself. He flagellated himself to the point of total collapse. And this is the attribute which is called saintly. It is a total denial of the vicarious death of Jesus Christ, who became sin for me, who took upon himself my sinfulness so that he paid the price for it. In him I am free. I have no need for the works of self-flagellation. This was an act of open controversy, denying the very Protestant principles on which the United States were based. Consequently, after this canonization, it's interesting that it was probably, so they believe, Native Americans actually defaced the statues of Junipero Serra in an act of defiance, throwing paint upon them and writing words of a derogatory nature over the tombstones, etc. So not everybody was well pleased with this first gesture of the Pope. When he was greeted at the White House, it was the most illustrious ceremony ever afforded a foreign dignitary. He was referred to as the example of humility to mankind. And in his speech, he also referred to the immigrant issue, and that everybody was at one stage an immigrant, and that the doors should be opened, that America should be one. So this theme was very recurring in his speeches. The most interesting one was, of course, the Capitol. Now, the Capitol, as we discussed previously, is a fascinating building, and it actually refers back to ancient Rome, the Capitol, which is a Roman idea, and it is basically a copy of St. Peter's. It is a temple. So in a sense, the shepherd one was entering into the temple.
Mr. Speaker, the Pope of the Holy See.
Now that Pope Francis has completed his mission to the United States, it is time for a little bit of reflection as to what happened during that visit. When we discussed what was going to happen, I think we summed up more or less what he was going to do. There was one or two surprises, but generally speaking, it was a masterpiece of media and social performance. When Pope Francis arrived in his airplane and it landed, and he was greeted by the President and the Vice President of the United States of America and his family, there was a reception such as had never been afforded any foreign dignity in the history of the United States.
And I'll tell you, as the plane pulled up, I watched the crowd here lean up against the fences that are around the grandstands here, every one of them pushing forward with a phone or a camera in their hands to capture this moment. You're watching now, as you can see, that red carpet about to roll out. And it was interesting, about an hour ago, we saw them roll out the red carpet, and we thought, oh, they've rolled out the red carpet. That was just a practice run. They have practiced everything to a T here, including that perfectly lined up honor guard you're seeing there as well. They want to get this right. It's a special moment. It's a historic moment. We got a remarkable seat here. So I have to tell you, Jake, and I've seen official visits before, I haven't seen one quite like this.
The aircraft with which he landed and all subsequent aircraft received the code Shepherd 1. And then the symbolic meaning of his visit. The pomp and ceremony surrounding his visit alone speaks of the high esteem in which the world holds this pontiff.
It's an extraordinary moment. First of all, the joy is palpable, not only here. The joy in Philadelphia as we're talking here, as we're waiting here. There's 17,000 delegates to the World Meeting of Families watching this great event in Philadelphia. The people of New York, very, very happy that he's coming. What's happening here is for the whole world. The world is watching this particular visit. For me personally, the Holy Father is the vicar of Christ. He's our leader. He's our shepherd. And when you know the shepherd, it makes an even bigger difference.
stations. All hands man your battle stations. This is a drill. This is a drill.
And then implementing a tyrannical system of control.